We sent the invitation last week. It was not MEC to put you on the spotlight, but well, systems here may not be not the same, and we then said, fine, because they are the nearest, let's call them first. So that is why you are here. We want to have, as the invitation has said, that we want provinces to give us the state of the health sector in your province. And I'm of the understanding that everything was listed of what is it that we are then. And we are humbly requesting that we please give us the situation. Because we are not here as big brothers and big sisters, but we are here to say together we have got the responsibility of ensuring that the sector, those that are serviced and those that are servicing the sector, are in an environment that is going to enable them to really feel that, in particular, those that are receiving. And therefore the health care, we're in that state. We do understand and quite clear of what the National Health Act entails and what then becomes our responsibility. But we always say, whether there's concurrence or no concurrence, that person who is in Khayelitsha Clinic now as we are seated is expecting to go home at 10 o'clock. That's what she or he expects, to go home at 10 o'clock with treatment. That nurse that is taking care of a patient in Khabo, just make an example, primary health clinic, she is expecting to have everything and be able to do her work in such a manner that is not going to compromise a patient and herself. And when we talk about leadership, we don't mean the department, the HODs, or the MEC's office. We mean, because that's where things are happening on the ground in clinics. And we do think that health is central in whatever program that this country wants to deliver, being in education, being in economy, being in labor. Without a healthy labor force, and therefore we have got that responsibility. And as the portfolio committee, we really want to have an understanding of what is the situation. So that's the basics of a request is that don't leave anything, whether good or bad, tell us, so that we are then able to have an understanding. We have received presentations. AG, compliance, we got those presentations. Now we want to hear from you. We will cross-reference. So that's why we say be open and honest to us. We're not here to judge you. We'll criticize where there's a need to be criticized. We'll be blunt if there is a need to be blunt, but it's not about anything else, but it's ensuring that the people of South Africa, now it's Western Cape, of the Western Cape, do receive the services in as far as the center is concerned, in line with what the Constitution is saying. So we will do the housekeeping that I was welcoming. We'll do the housekeeping, which is the introductions, and two, that phones are to be on silent. If you want to then have to answer your phone, you will go outside to answer it. Three, we introduce ourselves using mics. Whoever is here is to tell us where he or she is coming from. So your name, the surname, your institution is going to be very important. And people that are going to ask questions are members to the Department of Health of Western Cape as the presenter. So all other people are to just sit and listen. If they want to ask when we break for tea, then they can ask. But when the committee is in session, only two people are to speak, honorable members and the provincial department of health. My name is Lindela Tunjo. I'm the chair of the portfolio committee on health. Next to me is
Morning, honorable chairperson. My name is Tisang Mutumi, and I'm standing in for Vuyokazi Majalamba as the committee secretary.
The extreme back is Mbali, who's the committee secretary. Next, committee assistant, sorry. Next to Mbali is Nolthando, who's the secretary of the study group of the African National Congress. Others will introduce as they arrive. Over to you, honorable members, for introduction.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Fish Masha.
Good morning. My name is Mbulelo Nkonzo, member of the committee. Thank you.
Morning. I'm Donald W. B. Mapam, a member of this portfolio committee. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Lindy Walton. I'm a member of this portfolio committee.
Good morning. My name is Patricia Kopani. I'm a member of this portfolio committee. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Rachel Adams, member of the committee.
Over to you. Okay. We can take this one.
Morning, Chair and honorable members. Kamalam Dongkawagas from the Deputy Minister's Office.
Good morning, members. My name is Riyad Adamson, and I'm from the Parliamentary Monitoring Group.
Hi, I'm Marvin Charlton from the Cape Argus.
Good morning, I'm Douglas Newman Valentine, Head of Ministry, Western Cape Ministry of Health.
Morning, Chairperson, honorable members. I'm Beth Engelbrecht, the Head of the Health Department in the Western Cape.
Good morning, members. My name is Keith Clutty. I am the Chief of Operations in the Western Cape Department of Health.
Good morning. I'm Krish Balamji. I'm responsible for strategy and health support in the Western Cape Department of Health.
Morning. Noma French and Bombo, Paul Calhart for the health in the government.
No, thank you very much, MEC. What we will then do now, we will hand over to you. How and who is then going to lead the presentation depends on you. But before that, I think we don't have any apologies, honorable members, except just one apology of Ms. Majalamba, who will be here late, going to come later because she is attending to the issue of her mother's health. So that's why there is a gentleman who's standing in. Honourable Wilson?
Thank you, Chair. Sorry, while we are on apologies, I did speak to the committee secretary yesterday. I have to fly here from Polokwane, and with delayed flights and a motor breakdown, by the time I got out of Cape Town Airport, it was 5:30, and hence, but despite the fact that I said I was late, I did not arrive yesterday, and I do apologize. Thank you.
You are referring to yesterday's apology.
Formally apologize.
No, we got your apology yesterday. No, that's fine. Oh, the other person that has indicated my apology, Honourable Tembekwayo, is studying in science and technology. She's going to join us later. Remember that she's also a member of science and technology. Yes, Honourable Kupa.
Thank you, Chair. Honourable Lungiswa James, she also put an apology since yesterday for making matters their crisis. Thank you.
Okay. No, there's something that is just a little bit disturbing me, but I'm not going to address it now in your presence. I will address it at the other time. Over to you, MSC.
Okay, and Bulele ku Honorable Slalo for giving us this opportunity to present. But can I just ask what is the time frame? Because we've got 120 slides, and I'm aware that the honorable members will prefer probably to engage. So you don't want to be doing this too much of the slides, and then we end up not having opportunities in terms of responding to the questions. So what will the time frame duration so that they can be able to skip?
You are here until 11:30. In fact, until 1:00. Until 1:00. That includes everything, discussion. So you are here until 1:00.
Thank you. The HOD is going to lead the presentation and going to direct which portion from each of her colleagues will speak about. And then for the questions, myself and HOD will lead the responses and then divert for those specific ones that need to be responded by the colleagues. Again, Dr. Plute is a DDG, a COO, focusing mostly on all the clinical governance issues, where he will be able to respond on any issues related to the clinical aspect. Because he has a direct contact mostly with the CEOs of the hospital. Dr. Vallabhji, strategic support, issues related to the risk management, to the e-vision, on any other issues related to the support. Of course, HOD as an accounting officer has got the overall responsibility. Again, thank you for the time. I think the preamble I want to do is going to be short, but probably I might be speaking on behalf of the whole of the health system. I'm aware that my colleagues from other provinces will be coming over here. First of all, us as the health system, including the Western Cape, our core responsibility is on rendering health services. But health is everybody's business. And therefore, that's why we understand very well that when anyone probably raises issues of concern about us, it's not about the person who's trying to attack us or something personal. It's about the interest of everyone in the whole of, especially the patients or even the families. We are not necessarily patients. So therefore, for us, we don't dismiss when things are raised about our systems, but it's about it. Either it's a learning lesson, or we listen and we regroup, and then we respond, and we do not make excuses. That is crucial because we are aware that people are raising these issues because it's very important. It's focusing on people when they are at the weakest moments. The reason I was asking for the time was generally for health. It's not only one system. It's made up of systems. One system on its own, it can form actually a department. What are those systems? The HR is a system on its own because we've got more than 10 health professional categories, plus also those who are not necessarily defined as health professionals, but also they are part of the carers in our systems. Second system is an information system, which is on its own because it's not only about from the patient to the carer, but also for the whole of connecting all these facilities. Within that facility, the interventions within that facility together with other facilities outside, plus also with the referral system, so it's a system on its own. Financing, health financing is a system on its own that needs a whole pack of other interventions and innovative approaches on its own. It could take us even a whole day if you could talk about financing. Leadership and governance within the context of health is completely different from in other sectors, because it's a system on its own in terms of how to meet all of those conversion and also other aspects, also in regard to what is happening outside the health system. Availability of medicines and technology and research is a system on its own. Hence, we take into cognizance the work we do with the medical schools, through the nursing colleges, and so forth. And lastly, what we normally see and define as health, it's a services, yet which is another system. Yet all five other systems have to play a major role in order for one to dish out that panado, that service, that care that is being provided. So sometimes what is happening behind the scenes is not necessarily known generally by the public around that. Having said that, the three challenges facing South Africa, unemployment, inequality, and the poverty impacts too much more on health probably than in any other aspects. Because when people are unemployed, they don't have jobs. It means that they depend on the public because they don't have medical aid. And we know that wealth and health, they are twins. When a person is poor, a person is likely to be ill. When the person is ill, we're likely to be poor because they have to spend so much money in order to get better. So this affects us quite a lot, and when the economy is low and slow, it impacts on health, even if the budget increases. But now we have to rob Paul and pay Pauline in terms of the price of a medicine and equipment and all of those so forth. Now, coupled with the increase in the population, because people can move anywhere where they want, in the Western Cape, as just like Gauteng, SSA showed that it's under pressure in terms of the increase in the population. And also with the quadrupling of disease, which is the mental health, maternal and child health aspect, and most importantly, the chronic conditions, HIV/AIDS, and lastly, the mental health, this impact on us. Hence, we'll find that although our population, we say this 80% of the population, which is now, I think, around about 6.4 compared to 5.3 in 2011, but it means that we see almost 14 million in our primary health care services. So HOD, they're going to today, we have been asked to present specifically mostly on hospitals, which is we have 53 hospitals. Out of those, we have two central hospitals, one tertiary hospital. We have 11 specialized hospitals that is made up for psychiatry and one rehab, and also the others are TB hospitals. So our presentation is mainly focusing on the aspects of the hospital. Again, it's only the hospital services. We still have got other layers below, which is related to the whole primary healthcare approach, which is not part of today. We'll take up the questions and then over to HOD.
Thank you, Minister. Thank you, Chairperson. So the briefing that was requested was on 21 topics. And the focus was on hospitals, yet it went into broader aspects of district health system, EMS, etc. So we tried to cover as most as we can to be able to respond to the desire. So from our side, we believe this is a great opportunity for us to paint the picture of the province. We've covered the areas as requested, but if more detail is required, we can have that. We also have copies of our APP with us if the committee would like us to leave that behind. And we also have the annual report. So all of these are further public documents that the committee could use, but I heard from your chairperson you've got more than that, you've got from the Office of Health Standards, AD, you've got lots of other sources of information, and we welcome that. It's important that we are mirrors held against us to see where can we improve. The first aspect you would like to cover from your list is governance and leadership, and I fully agree with you, Chairperson. One of the aspects as a department is focusing on is make sure that leadership happens at every level. You can show leadership qualities even if you are a cleaner working in a setting. The values and the qualities of leadership must be throughout the department. That's one of our key values. So for any governance and leadership system to work, you need to have a long-term, you need to have a vision. And we have captured our vision in Healthy 2030, our road to wellness. And you would notice that it's not on illness, it's on wellness. We try to say that we are a health department for wellness. So I'll come back to that a bit later. That document is available, and that has been that is the kind of the vision that we are embarking upon. In the document, it gives us a few shifts that we need to make. The document is aligned to the NDP. So on the right-hand side, I can just indicate that our vision focuses on people-centered care, on transformational leadership and governance. We recognize that the stresses and the shocks to the health system are quite significant. The budget cuts over the past years across the whole health sector has been significant. And how do we, as a health leadership, then transform and adapt to that? Integrated systems approach. The minister painted out a range of systems, but they can't stand alone. We need to see how do we integrate those. And then a shift to wellness and universal health coverage, but also universal health care. There's a difference between coverage and care. So on the left-hand side in the circle, show that the shifts that we would like to make is to show compassion, be coordinated, be comprehensive, continuous care, accessible, and family-centered. Chairperson, so the slide to us, we actually spent a lot of time to get our heads around what do we mean by governance and what is the role of the health department in a province. We recognize that health is a basic human right and that we've got a constitutional role and a responsibility in this regard. We also recognize, Chairperson, the point that you made is that health is the center of everything. We recognize that health is the universal recipient of anything that goes wrong in communities. Whether it's violence, whether it's poverty, whether it's all the aspects that Minister has mentioned, we are the universal recipient. And how do we lead and govern to be able that health improves? So we've, from the World Health Organization, there is kind of looking at governance from two perspectives. The one is governance of health, and the other one is governance for health. So governance of health is what all health departments do. We must govern the systems that ultimately deliver health services. But as the Minister has indicated, for us to really improve health, we have to look at the upstream factors. And I will come back to that later. So when we look at governance, Madam Chair, we look at it from both angles, and we're learning a lot in that broader approach to the governance of health and the governance for health. The accounting officer and the HOD and the senior responsible team is responsible for both these aspects of governance. And the way that you govern is how you organize yourself, how you take decisions, and how you delegate authority. We have established governance arrangements for strategy and ensuring accountability, monitoring. So our governance arrangements provide for accountability. It provides for us to monitor, and it provides for us to take decisions. We also subscribe to the King IV Governance Guidelines for performance, accountability, ethical culture, and legitimacy. And just to mention, one of the products of good governance that we believe, one of the markers is, do we have unqualified audits? One of the critical things of governance is also how do we perform in patient experience and quality, and I will spend a few minutes on that as well. So these are just our governance arrangements. This is not our organizational structure. This is just how we govern our department. The MEC is the ultimate head with particular roles and responsibilities. Myself and the MEC are very clear in terms of our roles and the boundaries. And there is a strategic governance executive that gives, that works with the HOD to give guidance, strategic guidance to the department. We have a top executive committee that looks at how do we give effect to our mandate. And then from that, we've got a team focusing on operations, the OPEXCO, so they focus on all the operational aspects in the department. We have a committee for accountability and monitoring in M&E for your predetermined objectives, and in finances, the financial monitoring committee, where we then focus on the accountability and the monitoring of our financial performance. So this is just explanation. I'm not going to go into that in detail. There are also other statutory governance structures, the Provincial Health Council, which the Minister chairs. There is a District Health Council in every district, and there are hospital boards and clinic committees. We have hospital boards for several years, and in 2017 we incorporated also the legislation for clinic committees. The regulations have been passed, and the implementation is in progress. And we are formalizing the establishment of clinic committees to be formally, every member to be formally appointed by the minister. We've got informal structures at the moment, but that will now be formalized. Now, the governance for health, I would like to focus on one particular aspect that we have, Chairperson, is a whole of society approach. The principle behind that is, what is the value proposition and the strategic intent to have a whole of society approach? Is to positively change the story for people in the Western Cape. But we realize health can't change the story. You need safety, you need social services, you need education. So for us to change the story and the role that we have to play, what is the value proposition that the whole of society would give us? And we use a learning lens to connect and collaborate towards that shared purpose, and to integrate economic transformation strategies in our communities with social transformation strategies. To do either one of them, we are not serving our communities properly. So that is part of the value proposition. And the ultimate shared purpose is to achieve safe, socially connected, resilient, and empowered citizens and communities with equitable access to services and opportunities. So that is where we want to go as a collective, and health is playing a leadership role in that regard. We use a range of policy parameters through a lens of the Bill of Rights to ensure that we are globally connected but locally relevant. So this is just a very busy but a schematic indication, Chairperson, of how we view the whole of society in local communities. So you'll see at the top we say, what is the Bill of Rights from our Constitution, and what are these, the numbering there are very relevant to what we have to do. Then there are sustainable development goals. Which ones of those are relevant for us to be able to perform and change the story of the lives of people? The national development plan, and then the provincial strategic plan, and then the integrated development plan of municipalities. So we ultimately say that for us to have a whole of society approach in communities, we have to take cognizance of all those parameters and how we land those grand ideals in our communities. So we've got the citizen-centric approach as part of whole of society, and you'll see the citizens are in the middle, and to the left, the Department of Health, which is the largest department in the province with the largest penetration into people's houses. No other department has got that penetration. So the health department has got the largest footprint of any department in the province. Working with us is the Western Cape Education Department, Department of Social Development, Sports, Arts and Culture, and you'll see all of them are blue. They are the major service delivery departments. Public Works, Human Settlements are in the enabling spaces, Community Safety and Agriculture similarly, and those that are in red are the ones that speak into the governance space of a whole of a province approach. But all of us, together with the municipality at the top, are the ones that then ultimately have an impact on the citizens. We recognize very early in our journey that unless we work and empower our municipalities to do what they have to do as a department on its own, we will not be able to make that difference. So that is the journey we have embarked upon as a whole of society approach. I would like to move to quality of care, Madam Chair. You did ask us to be honest and open. So we would like to give you everything that we have. We have to recognize that the department is under significant service pressure. when you talk to staff on the ground, they say we've got a burning platform. So we know that staff are under terrible pressure. But when you move around, you find the most amazing people to do what they have to do, where they are with what they've got. We do all in our ability to be able to support them. You will always find individuals who crack under the stress, who are not living our values, and then we go in and see how do we support that individual, how do we support the system that is causing an individual to not live the values that we as a department hold dearly. So we are open, we recognize. People wait for their services. They wait long. They wait hours. The minister, I last night until after 10 o'clock was communicating on a patient waiting in one of our hospitals. So we know that patients wait. We know that that these things happen, but we really try to do our best with what we've got. So primary health care, 14.1 million patient contacts in our facilities. It does not include contacts with people in their homes or in other community-based settings. So the school health services, home-based care is not included in the 14.1 million. Nearly 93,000 babies were born last year. And you see there the number of children that we've immunized and our immunization coverage. We would like to get to 85%. We're not there yet, and we put a lot of effort to be able to get there. The separations means actually the number of patients that we've admitted in our hospital is 537,000 in our acute hospitals. We've got 257,000 people on ARV for HIV/AIDS. And we've got nearly 500,000 emergency cases that were transported with our ambulance services. And nearly 30% of them are priority one. So we've got a differential response time for priority one calls. Health outcomes, we are very grateful that our health outcomes are amongst the best, but not ultimately in everything the best, but we strive to really continue to improve what we have. So the life expectancies, what have become the macro markers, it has increased over the past 15 years. For men, it is nearly 67 years, and for women, 71.8 years. The National Development Plan wants us to get to 70 years. So for women, we're already beyond that. Men, we're not there yet. And we find that our men, especially in the ages between 18 and 35, violence is a massive impact. On our young men, and we really try to find ways, and that is why we reverted to our society approach to be able to see how we tapped into that particular grouping in our society. The maternal mortality ratio, Madam Chair, the figure might not be that meaningful, but I just want to say that as a country we're trying to improve. The province that is closest to us is over 100, so we do believe that we have made significant inroads. Obviously we still have some work to do. The neonatal mortality rate is 9 per 1,000 live births, but we have to recognize that is at a macro level. There might be pockets in our province where it's higher than this, and we identify those pockets and we go in and we make the difference. Infant mortality rate is there, the under 5 mortality rate is there, the NDP wants the under 5 mortality rate to be below 25. So we are there already, but we want to go further, we want to improve further. We have got a 0.5% transmission rate from mother to child on HIV. Again, we are grateful for this improvement, but yet you still find that a pregnant mother who is HIV positive pass on the virus to the child in 0.5% of the time. But so clearly we are diligent to follow that up to make sure that we at least protect the child. And then we've got the TB cure rate. Complaints and compliments. We've kind of gave you a very clear picture there, Chairperson, of our reality. You can see where the most, so the second column is the number of complaints. The third column is the percentage of those complaints. Then you get the number of compliments and then the percentage of the compliments. So if you look at the complaints at the largest percentages, so the most of the complaints are about care and professional treatment. But if you take that row to the right, you also see that most of the compliments, 71% of the compliments, are on exactly the same aspect. So we're doing certain things right. but we're also doing certain things wrong. And if you look at the numbers, the number of complaints in that space is 1,500, whilst the number of compliments is 8,500. So clearly we're grateful for that, but we recognize there is certain some work that we still have to do. And then at the very bottom is waiting times. So waiting times, you can see there's much more complaints than compliments. So very clearly that is one of the pressures in our systems, that we do know that patients wait long. There's a few people that have complimented us about the waiting times, but clearly that is one of our Achilles heels. So at the top in the orange box, Madam Chair, you can see the total number of complaints has been 4,800, and the total number of compliments have been 11,000. But you have to go into the detail. So we know that waiting times is one of the areas that we do know that that people are complaining about. Then, I'm not going to go into the details here, Chairperson. This is for your purpose. So when you go then further into what are in those, the complaints and the compliments, where we unpack that, what lives in that data, because every piece of data is an individual who had an experience of our service. So the complaints are dissatisfaction from the patient's perspective of poor service delivery, from the patient's perspective that they would like the facility to have more doctors. The compliments are good service, excellent care, competent caring. The waiting times, the complaints are they wait to see health professionals, they wait for appointments, and they wait to get their medication. So those are complaints that we are aware of, and our systems are trying to address those. The compliments are reduced waiting times for chronic medication, because we are now dispensing chronic medication in other places, church halls, creches, other places where patients can go collect their medication, and we have received some compliments. Staff attitudes, that is the third highest number of complaints, but also the number of compliments in that space. So that's something that we do believe, that staff attitude is largely a reflection of the culture of our organization and how we support our staff. So we're working very hard, and Minister Mbombo specifically, that's one of the things that she champions. I'm not going to go into details. This is just on those three matters, Madam Chair, what we are doing for care and professional treatment. We invest a lot in staff recognition, in leadership development, culture change, that people feel respected, people feel that they're listened to. So a lot of our managers are visible in our services. We really go out and understand the reality of our staff. We strengthen clinical governance. We use our specialists and our doctors and our clinical nurse practitioners for the clinical governance role that they have to play. We're also looking at IT systems, because there's a lot of data that staff have to collect that actually burdens them, and how can we reduce the time that they spend on data collection and rather spend on looking at staff. Outreach, national core standards, and ideal clinics. So all of these are in the care and professional space. Waiting times, there's a long list there, because we know that is the area that requires the most attention. We've got appointment systems. They are not yet perfect, but we're working on those, and we get as soon as the community gets used to that, we find that people wait much longer. Patient flow management, so when the patient moves to the facility, that they have as least touch points as possible. Unfortunately, we said that old infrastructure, it takes time to replace that, and we know that that is one of the areas that we have to work on. We're looking at our registry to make sure that the files, the folders that should not be there, are out of the registries. Alternate sites for dispensing, I've discussed that. We monitor the waiting times. We manage the waiting list for elective surgery. We've got help desks and queue marshals, and we work very hard to improve national core standards and the ideal clinic standards. Staff attitude, we've got staff wellness program to support staff, whether it's financial, relationship, drugs, whatever staff are dealing with, we've got wellness program for those. We manage and assist staff involved in complaints related to staff attitudes. So if there's a particular complaint, we engage with that staff member. The culture is not to blame and judge, to try and rather to understand and see how we can support that staff member. But if need be, then have to move towards correcting actions. And then we've got a leadership behaviour charter on our values. So we've got 7 values, and for each one of them we've identified the behaviours, and we hold each other accountable for that. That's also in the performance agreements of staff. National core standards, these are the self-assessments in hospitals, Madam Chair. You would notice that we still have to work on this, and I'm sure the Office of Health and Compliance gave their perspectives of this. This is self-assessments, where the staff assess it themselves, or the peer one hospital assesses another. So we've got some work to do. Mowbray Maternity Hospital is there lifted out. This is a particular one. The critical thing there, Madam Chair, is a very, very old infrastructure. And a lot of things have changed. And although there were pockets of improvements, our ability to have places for folders, our ability to have places for waste, and all of those is largely infrastructure related. But we know, and the team is actively busy improving on those core standards. Ideal Clinic, we've 94% of those clinics that we have targeted have done their determination, and we have received nearly 60% Ideal Clinic status. So this is also an area that we're working on. A lot, again, is based on whether a clinic is a satellite clinic and should have all the core standards, or whether there are infrastructure aspects, but we are systematically making progress in that regard. Then, Madam Chair, I will ask Dr. Clutty to deal with the reports.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and the committee members. So what I'm going to do is very quickly give you a landscape of what the services look like and where it is in the Western Cape. So just to orientate you, the first one is we have 6.5 million people in this province. That is based on the mid-year 2017 Stats SA figures, and it's distributed in six districts. So you have Central Karoo, Eden, Overberg, Cape Winelands, West Coast, and then you have the Cape Metro being the biggest district from a population perspective, the smallest district from a area space perspective. Next one. So just to orientate you, our entire service delivery platform is described by this onion peel that you see on the screen, and it's really about, if you talk from the outside inwards, is that our biggest and widest reach is community-based services. So it's teams of community health workers, followed by what we call facility-based services. Those are our primary healthcare facilities. That is the most distributed through the entire geographic space of the Western Cape, followed by district hospitals, then specialized hospitals or regional hospitals, and then your tertiary and central hospitals. And on the side, we have EMS, FPS. That means it's your ambulances together with your health net, which is transporting people. And you also have forensic pathology services, which is the mortuaries that feeds in the criminal justice system. So that is the way, and on the right-hand side, you have specialized hospitals. So out of all the hospitals we have specialized hospitals for TB, for psychiatry, for rehab, and those are the kind of hospitals that plays out in our space. Next slide. So this looks like, one person always make a joke, it looks like a children's party invitation. But the issue is, what we do is, our model of care is that although I've described all these things, in a geographic area, they come together. So we describe it almost like a geographic ecosystem. So you can go to any geographic area of our province and you'll find these playing itself out. So the blue dots is those primary care facilities that I spoke about. But connected to every primary care facility is your green dots, which is your community health worker teams. So that is where our footprint of our healthcare system is. The gray dot at the bottom is something we call intermediate care, and that is step-down care. So when people come out of a hospital, before they go into their home, they go into a step-down facility. When you get to the orange dot, that is your district hospital. So your district hospital then supports two or three more primary care facilities. The purple one, which is your regional hospital, supports two or three or more district hospitals. So it's a cascading model of support. And you also find in a specialized hospital in that area, and an EMS station or a forensic pathology set. So although I've mentioned all of them, in any geographic area you'll find them together. And they become a family of interconnected healthcare delivery points in that area. The next slide. The one that sits outside that local geographic area is our highly specialized hospitals. So that is Groot Schuur, Tygerberg and Red Cross.
Now, we only have three in this province. Two are central hospitals, and they're massive. I'll come back to them. Grootski and Tigerberg, and the Red Cross is a tertiary hospital. So those three hospitals is not in every geographic area. They're highly specialized, and out of all our geographic areas, patients find their way to those hospitals. So just a little bit about district health. I'm going into these six districts that you saw on the map. And what I'm doing in each one is just to give you a very, very overview of what lives in the district. Now, the first one is the most complex one, is the Cape Metropole. But I'll take you, a very interesting thing, if I take you through all of these, just note the one figure. And it is on the right-hand side, it says population density. It's 1,530 people per square meter. So in our metro, sorry, per square kilometer. So per square kilometer, so that means a kilometer times a kilometer, there's 1,530 people living in the Cape Metro for every square kilometer. I'll come to the other districts and you'll see the comparison of how many people they live per square kilometer in each of the other districts. So of this, of our 6.5 million people, 4.1 lives in the Cape Metro with that population density. Now that 1,530 per square kilometer in a metro is not uniform in the whole metro. So you go into certain pockets in the metro, it is much higher. Because in a metro, you still have Table Mountain, you still have Cape Point, you still have a little bit of the Philippi agriculture area, and you still have, as you go out a little bit, Joostenburg, Vlaktes, some farmlands. So to have 1,530 people per square kilometer, you can imagine in the three places where we are the densely populated, most densely populated, which you can't see nicely on the map, is Khayelitsha, Mitchells Plain, and Klipfontein. The density of people per square kilometer is much higher than it is 1,500 per square kilometer. And if you, it just has to take you to drive on the N2, past the airport, to look to your left, that you can see that that is where the density is in the Cape Metro. There's a little bit of, I'll give you a little bit of more information about the facilities, but I'll come back to this. The big point about this slide is that we still have a fragmented primary care facility service. And if you add them all up to the left-hand side, you'll see that there's 101 service points, which is run by the City of Cape Town. It's a local, the municipality of Cape Town. Whereas to the right-hand side, the second line, it says PGWC. Just to remind Dr. Balaji, we've long been not PGWC. Is the provincially managed primary care facilities, which happens to be 56. So one of our biggest challenges in the Cape Metro is that we have city facilities and provincial facilities for primary care. And some of them are in the same building. So you have a city staff and province staff in the same building giving services to the people. And some of them are in close proximity to one another, like within a kilometer of one another. And it's a fragmented way of rendering a healthcare service to the population. So that's one of the big things of the slide that comes up. The next slide. So I'm not going to, Dr. Balaji was testing my fortitude to see whether I'm going to take you through every line on the slide. I can give you relief, I'm not going to take you through every line of the slide. What this is, on the left-hand side, we're giving you all the data that we have at the snapshot for the Cape Metro. So on the left, this is our expected patient volumes. Now you heard Dr. Engelbrecht talk about the patient volumes for the whole province. This is for this district. So we expect 9.6 million headcounts in that primary care platform that I just showed you for this 18-19. So we started in April till March next year. We expect 9.6 contacts. And that you can't, if you really have to break that down, you go to Site B, Community Health Center in Khayelitsha. You expect 1,000 people a day to be in that facility. That's how this breaks down into the various facilities that goes in the area. On the left bottom side is the one that I would say on each of these slides would be important for you to reflect on. Because what this is, it tells us what people die of in this geographic area. And this is the deaths out of 2015. Some people have asked us, why is it so long? These are the deaths that has come out of Home Affairs, has been verified, and we've done an analysis on it with the MRC. So the leading causes of death, if you look on the left bottom side, for single leading causes of death, you see something that we probably 5 years ago thought we will not see in the metro, is that the single leading cause of death is diabetes, followed by HIV. Now for, you know, 5, 10 years ago, it was HIV, TB, then other things. Now we're seeing, because of the ART program, that the leading cause of death has become HIV. Has become diabetes, followed by HIV, followed by ischemic heart disease, TB lying in fifth place, and they, you know, so you see a diabetes, ischemic heart disease, cerebrovascular disease, which is strokes, coming higher and higher up, because HIV and TB, the deaths due to HIV and TB in the Western Cape and in the Metro, has gone down significantly over the last 5 to 10 years. What is still our worrying thing, which does not show up too much here, is the violence. But that I'll come back to the violence. But this is the heading there says natural causes. So what it excludes is the causes due to non-natural causes, which is violence. So in the Cape Metro, HIV and TB has come down, but the death due to chronic diseases has come slightly up, but the big incline of deaths in the Cape Metro has been due to intentional injuries. It's gunshots and stabs. It's violence. So the big incline of deaths in the Cape Metro has been to violence, interpersonal violence. I'll come later into that to say how that plays itself out. So that is the main thing. On the right-hand side is what we expect for HIV-TB on the top, and what we expect for mother and children, because we think that's the most sensitive part of our system. But I won't go into too much of that. The next slide breaks the Metro Health Service into district hospitals on the left-hand side. I apologize for the small print, but it's in your handout. It takes the number of district hospitals that we have and break them up. So you will see that your biggest district hospitals that we have currently is Mitchells Plain Hospital. It's the second last one, 361 beds. And Khayelitsha Hospital, which is 300 beds. And then Karl Bremer Hospital, which is 311 beds. Now between those three hospitals, they are quite big district hospitals. Whereas you have smaller district hospitals such as Westphalia that only has 50 beds, that's in Atlantis, and False Bay, who is at Fishhook, which only has 76 beds. So that is the district hospitals in the metro. But you see most of them are bigger hospitals, and they start approximating what will happen in the regional hospital. So the kind of cases we see, and therefore we also have specialists in these hospitals, in Khayelitsha, Mitchells Plain, and in Karl Bremer. The regional hospital is Somerset Hospital. So at the moment there is virtually very little difference between Somerset Hospital, the regional hospital, and Khayelitsha, Mitchells Plain, and Karl Bremer in terms of caseload and what's being done in those facilities. But also Mowbray, which the HOD has mentioned. And the specialized hospitals, for instance, Lentegi Hospital has 720 beds, Stikland 318, Falkenberg 360 beds. So that is just a breakdown of what happens in the metro. So I'm going to go a bit faster. What is now going to follow is the five rural districts in a very similar manner. So I just want to lift out something. I'm not going to repeat everything I said in the metro. But if you come to this slide, the first one that you get is that Cape Winelands has got almost a million people. So it's just short of a million. It's 916,000 people. So other than the metro, Cape Winelands is the highest population density district outside the metro. And it makes sense because there are three big kind of towns that are quite urban in those. So it's Paarl, it's Stellenbosch, and if you go over the mountain, it's Worcester. So it's quite
densely populated around those three towns. So the population density now drops from 1,500 people per square kilometer to 43 people per square kilometer. And it's still the most densely populated district outside of Cape Town. So the density now becomes a completely different factor in terms of how many people live in a square kilometer radius. And then the facilities are there, and then the towns that lives in this area. So you'll see Witzenburg, that's kind of Kouwer-Bokkeveld, it's around Ceres. You'll see Breda Valley, which comes all the way from Toes River all the way to Worcester and Rawsonville. If you drive on the N1, you'll understand the passage of the N1 through there. Drakenstein is around Paarl, and Stellenbosch, as I explained, is Stellenbosch. And then Langeberg is Ashton, Montague, Robertson in that area. So that is the layout of what lives in Cape Winans. The next slide is the same slide that we have for the metro, but the left bottom corner for Cape Winans starts looking at what the single causes of death is in this area. And again, the issue here is as natural causes of death, so again it excludes the violence. But here, HIV is still the leading cause, followed by cerebrovascular, followed by diabetes. And so you go on in terms of the causes of death in Cape Winans. So I'm not going to repeat the others. You can see the data for your own self, what will happen in that sub-district where the facility is there. The next sub-district is then Central Karoo. Now, Central Karoo is the district that has probably got the largest, at least has got the largest geographic area with the fewest people. It's like Northern Cape. And if you look at the density, we have two people for every square kilometer that lives in Central Karoo. It's quite a mindset to get your head around that for every square kilometer there's only two people. Okay, and that's now taking Beaufort West. It obviously has quite a lot of more dense people in Beaufort West. But for the rest, literally, it's just vast areas with very few people in that area. The next slide after that, it is just to indicate again, left bottom, what is the left bottom is the cause of death. Now, interestingly in this area, it's chronic lower respiratory disease. It is TB, and then you get HIV, then you get cerebrovascular HIV. Those diseases is very much diseases of poverty. So if you understand the whole thing of TB and then this chronic lung disease, it's very much a disease of poverty. So there are, if we, and that's where Dr. Engelbrecht made the case. If we take our own map and you superimpose this map to poverty levels, joblessness and all of those, you will see the picture in Central Karoo picking out that specific area. I'll skip to the next slide again. Next one is Eden. We're moving now down to the George area. So it's all the way from Plettenberg Bay, which is Bito, to Hessequa, which is Heidelberg. And it's the garden route. If you go on the N2, you'll see that you'll recognize you drive by this nice places like Nisena, George, Mossel Bay, whatever. That's Central. That's Eden. Inland over the mountain is Oudtshoorn, Kannaland, and that makes up the Eden district. It is the second highest population after after Cape Winans, and the population density there is 27 people per square kilometer. The profile, the disease profile for that area, left bottom, again TB followed by HIV, then the other diseases that you find in this area. The next district is Overberg. Overberg is in between the metro and Eden. So if you go on the N2, it is when you leave and you go over the mountain, you get to Grabouw. When you get into Grabouw, you start with Overberg.
Can I just a little bit... I'm seated here, sorry to disturb you. I said, okay, are we in a workshop or... Because you are taking more time.
Okay.
I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, mm-hmm. but what we really want, the demographics of of the Western Cape will deal with that. But key is in this district, in this sub-district,
okay.
these are the challenges because we still have to come...
So in Overberg District, you have the community daycare centers, the fixed facilities, it's all listed there for you. That's the footprint of the primary care facilities in that area, and it's distributed in the four sub-districts as illustrated there. The next slide, which is the leading causes of death in that area, ischemic heart disease, cerebrovascular, malignant. So here you see chronic diseases being the leading cause of death. And actually, in terms of life expectancy, in the Western Cape, the life expectancy, the highest life expectancy is in Overberg. And the sub-district where it's the highest is in Agulhas. That means you live longest in Agulhas in terms as compared to any other sub-district in this province. And this is our expected patient volumes there, it's much less, and also what we want for HIV outcomes and for child and maternal outcomes in that area. Then the last one of the rural is the West Coast district. That is up on the N7. And the facilities there that you can see is distributed over those populations and over the sub-districts there. And the next slide, which is the causes of death, it is TB again comes up to the top, a lot of poverty in the West Coast, and then diabetes, cerebrovascular, and all the others follow. Our expected HIV, TB, and our child maternal health things are also listed there. Just to come then to this slide, so compared to the metro, what you have here is the hospital, so you have many more hospitals in the rural areas, but they're much smaller hospitals. So you have from Montague being 40 beds, to places such as Uniondale having 13 beds. So you have much smaller hospitals, but more in every town there would be a hospital. And the issue of the rural compared to metro, because of the population density in metro, is very busy, very highly pressurized hospitals. Rural hospitals is much more sparsely distributed hospitals, fewer beds and fewer people that actually utilize the services. So the pressure is not so acutely felt. The exception in the rural is where you have pockets of high pressure. And one of those pockets is Friedenberg in the Saldanha area. So if you go to Friedenberg Hospital, which finds itself in the West Coast, they're the one big exception that jumps out. It's got 81 beds, but because of Saldanha and the density of people moving into that area in search of jobs, it is like a metro hospital. There's pressure, there's lots of psychiatric patients, and there are lots of pressure that's felt in that area. Okay, so then just the next slide is then the rural regional hospitals. So those are George, Paul, and Worcester. They're bigger hospitals. They happen to be in the towns of George, Paul, and Worcester, which in themselves are also more densely populated, therefore also have more pressure similar to the metro hospitals because they're bigger hospitals and there's more people in the area. And the last slide in this group is to talk about the three big hospitals. Now you see these hospitals are big institutions. Grootski has 975 beds. Tigerberg, which is our biggest hospital, is 1,384 beds. And Red Cross is 272 beds. It's only a children's hospital. But the issue of what you find here is the upward migration of the pressures that plays itself out across the whole province and finding them into places like Tigerberg Hospital. Now, Tigerberg Hospital is probably the one single hospital that at any given time is experiencing the most pressures in the whole province because of its size and because of all the other hospitals in geographic areas that are connected to that hospital. So all the people are referring to that hospital. And we had a situation recently that our number of people waiting for emergency orthopedic surgery at Tigerberg Hospital, at any given time it escalated to over 100 urgent cases per day that has to be worked away. That has a knock-on effect for people that are supposed to come for elective knee surgery, elective hip surgery. And a lot of those orthopedic cases comes from the same thing, which is the violence that's causing the causes of death. So these are the pressures that we feel within this wider system. I'm going to go on to now the ambulance and the patient transport system. So the first one is the ambulance system. We have 49 ambulance stations in the five districts, rural districts, and in the four Cape Town divisions, call it that. We deal with almost 500 emergency cases in 2017-18 in a year. And the urban response times within 15 minutes was just short of 60%. I'll come back to this because it was a bit higher and our targets are higher, but I'm going to come back to the reason, one of the main reasons why that response time has dropped in the urban areas. The rural response time within 40 minutes is about 80%. So you see an ambulance getting to a call within 40 minutes. In 80% of cases it happens. In a metro, an ambulance getting to a call within 15 minutes, only 60% of the cases do we get with there in 15 minutes. And it's obviously affected by the bullet to the bottom there, which I'm going to explain to you now on the next slide. So the next slide is probably one of the most worrying things that as a health department we deal with. So there's one thing that keeps us awake and has kept the minister busy for the last year and the senior manager of this department busy for the last year is the attack on ambulances in this province. So what you're seeing here is the blue bar is 2016, the bar in the middle is 2017, and the bar on top is 2018. It's not getting better, it's getting more, the attacks. And you see obviously the brown bar on top, which is this year. Stops in May because we are now in June. We will be counting as we go. But in the month of May, there were 12 different attacks just for the last month on ambulance. That is the single highest, other than 11 in January past, of over the last 3 years of attacks on ambulance drivers. Now, 12 a month means there is an attack on an ambulance once every 3 days in this province, which in ourself, for us, is a public health challenge of big proportion. Again, the solutions does not lie with us. The solutions lie with the whole of society approach of what gets people to the point that they attack ambulances as easy prey for attacking an ambulance driver and an ambulance to get a cell phone off the person or to rob them of their belongings. So that's probably our biggest concern. Patient transport, this is talking about the network of people, that network of points where we pick up patients to come for experiences, mainly for outpatient appointments at bigger hospitals. So it's across the whole province. We're currently re-looking at it. We've also, in the metro, are using our health net quite a lot to transport patients between hospitals. So we're looking at ways, why are people being driven from one hospital to another so that we can reduce and free people up more to transport patients from home to where they need to be. And lastly, we've now got an electronic system which is streamlining the process a little bit better. So it's our entire network of what we call planned patient transport. It's health net vehicles. If you're on the Western Cape roads, you'll see a little combi that says health net to the sign. And it's taking a well enough patient from one place to the other that doesn't require an ambulance and a stretcher. The last part that I'm going to be dealing with is the referral system. So as I've indicated to you, we work on referral systems in those mechanisms from primary care to hospitals up the chain. And one of the things that we're doing now is to put in place that we can do this electronically. One of the biggest breakthroughs, I guess, in the last couple of years, if you go to a primary care facility, is somebody can tell you when a patient that they referred has been discharged. They can go to the system, they know exactly how long they stayed in the hospital, what was wrong with them, what they were discharged with. So it's an electronic system that people in primary care now can see what happened to their patients when they're back in the community for follow-up treatment. And just again, the child balloons card is the next one. And the referral system lives within this. I think I've tried to explain this to you. From every single place where we are, it works up this referral chain, all the way to Grootskie Red Cross or to Tigerberg via those bigger hospitals that I explained to you earlier. On TB, we have one slide. I just want to quickly tell you. There are challenges in TB. You see on the right-hand side, the top-hand side, one of the things that has happened in the Western Cape, Western Cape always had, up until Dr. Balogic in the middle, that probably be about 2000, where is that? Yeah. We have increasing TB cases all the way up to the year 2000. We are now seeing significantly since the year 2000 a drop in TB cases. And it's a combination of, we're thinking, the effectiveness of the HIV treatment program and obviously a combination of us treating TB cases a little bit more effectively. But we are starting to see a drop in new TB cases. The challenge, though, still is the initial loss to follow-up rate, which means once somebody is diagnosed with TB, to start their treatment. We are focusing very much on this. This is your positive diagnosis, when do you start treatment? And we're trying to minimize and manage them. Retaining people in care is another challenge. And then obviously the big challenge is the challenge of poverty and socioeconomic conditions that underlies this. Because as I said to you in Central Karoo, there's very few people to cure with TB in Central Karoo, but you still don't have everybody cured because of the poverty and the socioeconomic conditions in terms of being able to follow through. And then we've made some significant strides, which I won't go into too much detail. Community-based services is really the last thing from me, Chairperson, is the community health workers that we have in this province. We currently have 90 NPOs that we contract the community health workers through, and there's 3,700 community health workers. We are slowly moving them from what we call program-specific function, so that the health worker goes and does TB, does this. We're moving them to a more generalist function, which is generally supporting a group of people with all the health conditions, rather than using a function-specific approach. And we're trying to move them into prevention promotion, making sure that people stick to their medication, and to follow up people that has been discharged so that people don't have to go back and be readmitted into hospital. So we make them the front line of our prevention strategy in terms of keeping people out of hospital. They still work the 4.5 hours a day. The intention is to get to bigger coverage and to get to 8 hours. We also have a formal training program, and currently they are paid proportionally to 3,000 rand per month in this group of people. And then the next slide is just to show you where the 4.5 million contacts that is done by this group of people is happening. You'll see that 2.4 million of that is in the metro, you can expect that, and the others are distributed across all the other areas. So in addition to the 14 million primary care facility headcounts, there's an additional 4.5 million headcounts done with community health workers. Thank you.
Thank you, Balamchi. Dr. Balamchi will handle the further sections. Thank you.
So the next section we're going to move on to is the management of pharmaceuticals and medicine availability. So the first slide in this section just shows, tries to map out the range of factors that impact on medicine availability. So if we start anti-clockwise and work that way, pharmaceutical contracts, these are largely national tenders that are awarded. And sometimes there could be delays in awarding these contracts that impact on medicines. Rational medicine use, so how do we actually prescribe our medication, and then also from a patient point of view, adherence to medication. Expired stock, seasonal demands, so there are times of the year where we have surges in certain conditions, for example, the diarrheal season, and that pushes up the demand for certain things. Donations, so sometimes we get donation stock of medicines. Sustainable finance, we have a chronic dispensing unit in this province, and so working with them and making the medicines available. Transport systems, poor stock management at various levels, and then sometimes we have campaigns that also drive up the utilization of certain medicines or vaccines. Next slide. So the Cape Medical Depot is a key vehicle in managing our medicines in this province. So it really provides for the strategic stock holding within the department. It's the institution that looks at ordering and delivery of medicines and vaccines, and it anticipates and proactively manages the medicine shortages. So as soon as they pick up that there's a shortage and we're unable to procure from the suppliers, it starts to alert the system, it starts to play a role in moving medicines around or in looking at alternatives to some of the essential medicines, etc. The Cape Medical Depot is also responsible for interaction with suppliers around contract management, penalties for non-performance. It also monitors irrational ordering practices from certain facilities. In total, the stock at the CMD, there are about 2,200 items. So of these, about 800 are pharmaceutical items, but then there are about 900 non-pharmaceutical items. So these could be things like gloves and other consumables like stoma bags and those kind of things, and 500 direct delivery voucher lines. In the province, we also have a sub-depot, which is in Oudtshoorn, that manages the supply for the local Eden and Central Karoo districts. So as far as our systems go, we have a software system called JAC, and we've rolled it out to about 110 sites in this province. And this is a software system that enables us to monitor the stock on hand, orders placed at facility level, and then that enables our pharmacists to redistribute stock if there's a need to. We put out what we call a top 20 report by volume and expenditure, so we're able to monitor our utilization and expenditure on medicines. At the facility level, the local pharmacist there, together with his or her team, would proactively manage low stock levels, right? And that gets escalated, and then at the district level, between clinics, etc., they could move stock in those kind of situations. We have SOPs made available of how there's an early warning system for stockouts, and those could be made available to the committee should they wish. As far as the central hospitals go, these are the big hospitals. Dr. Kluti has referred to the bed sizes, and they procure medicines directly from the supplier, so they don't go via the CMD. So CMD takes care of the rest of the provinces, but the three big hospitals have direct deliveries. We also have a chronic dispensing unit that we've now just issued a new contract for the next 5 years. And the service model and the play between these different mechanisms are reviewed from time to time. Communication is a big thing. So when it comes to the availability of medicines, communicating alerts about stockouts, about moving medicines between facilities is key. And the Cape Medical Depot issues a weekly report on medicines, which is called a juice out report of exactly which items we are out of stock, and so it alerts the system about responding to that. In most cases, it's not kind of life-threatening essential things that are out of stock, so we're easily able to find alternatives, and it's not a highly significant or life-threatening situation. Okay? And at the bottom of that slide, it shows you all the things that we put on that weekly juice out report. And then the last slide just gives you some data about the pattern of juice out for the last financial year. And this is a two-weekly, each bar is every 2 weeks. And you can see in the main, it's between 50 and 60 items that there's a juice out, there's a shortage. And that shortage could be for a variety of reasons, like my initial conceptual slide. It could be a shortage from the suppliers. It could be a tender has not been awarded in time, etc. But that's the pattern for the last financial year. We then move on to human resources, which is a very different topic. And here we've just summarized. In the department, we have 31,549 employees. So this data is from our last annual report, which has just been submitted to Treasury now, or to DOTP. 93% of the employees are appointed in a permanent capacity. 63% of that are health professionals. Okay. 37% are administrative staff. That's a bit misleading because it's not only administrative staff. In the 37% is all categories of non-professional staff. So you could have cleaners, you could have other artisans, etc., who are in the 37%. Okay. Pharmacy assistants, etc. 72% are female and 28% male. So we can see we've got a large female-dominated department in that sense. 30% are African, 15% are white, 53% are colored, and 2% are Indian. That's the demographics, the racial demographics of the whole department. Okay? 51% of our senior management positions are held by females, and 185 employees are classified as disabled. The next slide just gives you the racial representativity of our SMS profile, and that's there's a legend on the side, and you can see that we have some hard work to do regarding African representativity in the SMS cadre. The following slide then shows the distribution of the number of staff by budget program. And the whole purpose of the slide is really just to say that almost 95% of our staff are within the service programs, but which are really two, three, four and 5, and also 7.3, which is forensic pathology. So if you add all of the staff in those programs, it comes up to 95% as a department. The next slide just gives a high-level indication of vacancy rates within our department, which averages it out for the last year. And you can see on your extreme right column what the overall vacancy rates are. The one in Program 6 is largely around the nursing colleges, which are included in Program 6. And there has been some uncertainty about the nursing college being taken over by CPUT or not, and therefore many of those posts were not filled. But that uncertainty has now been settled, and it is going to be staying with the department, and hopefully that will be addressed in the coming financial year. So we have about 31,549 staff. We also do a Barrett's survey every second year, and this is really about looking at the values of our staff and how does that compare to that of the organization. And it's a very good barometer to assess how our staff feel about the organization and is there an alignment between individual values and organizational values. So in 2011, when we started this process, there were what we call cultural entropy, which is a kind of limiting value. So it's the kind of negative values that staff feel. For example, if staff felt that we're very conscious about cost, or we are a very bureaucratic or hierarchical organization, those would be deemed limiting values, and that then gets added up. And in 2011, that added up to 26% entropy levels. Right? And that's very high for an organization from an industry point of view. So what we have done is, over the last several years, we've been putting a lot of effort into becoming a values-based organization. So we went through quite a participative process, taking our staff through workshops, developing a set of shared values, developing a leadership behaviors charter. So for each of the values that we speak of, what are the actions and behaviors we need to live out to give effect to those values? So for example, if our value is competence or caring or accountability, what does that actually mean? How do you live it out in your life? And we've been paying attention to that over the last several years. So we're glad to say that in our last Barrett survey in 2017, that entropy level has now dropped to 18%. And by the consultants that assist us with this, they actually commend us for that level of improvement, because culture change and changing values is not an easy thing. It's quite an intensive process, and I think we're doing quite well on that front. So on overall, we've been an improvement of 2% in each of those four assessments we've done from 2011 to 2017. The main challenges as far as human resources and people management go is the impact of the increase in the public sector wage bill. So we're still recovering from the last increase in the public sector, and we know there are negotiations taking place currently. Right? But the problem is, whatever the increase is, the department doesn't get in its budget the equivalent amount to compensate for that. So there's always a shortfall, which then means it puts pressure on the rest of the budget and on goods and services and other things. So that's a huge challenge. The second one is, owing to budget pressures, the limited filling of posts. Right? So the slide that I showed on vacancy rates, that oftentimes it's because of budgetary pressures we're just not able to fill posts. And we've been very prudent about exactly every post that needs to be filled. Do we need it? Can we delay it? Can we do it differently, etc. So that puts pressure on the services. Staff safety, Dr. Kluti has spoken about that and shown you some data. And then, of course, intractable service pressures. Dr. Engelbrecht referred to that. That's just the reality. It's every day the service is under quite a bit of pressure, be it in the central hospitals or be it right down to primary healthcare level. And I think we need to concede on that. I'll hand over to Dr. Engelbrecht.
Thank you, Madam.
Sorry. Okay. I'm just a question that you have got. I'll just give you a grace of 40 minutes. So you will have to, yes. But it doesn't mean, Doc, that you will, because that's where the gist is. So, of the issues that you are really in. So, yeah. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll try my best to do that. So the focus that you have asked us to give a briefing on is on infrastructure, health technology, laundry and waste management. And as the Minister said, each one of those are big issues. I know that National Treasury has worked on the supply chain process for laundry for 3 years, and they've not yet solved the problem. So I think we have to recognize that we're dealing with complex matters, but I'll try my best to give the committee an appropriate briefing. So these are the issues that you have asked us to look at. So as far as medical equipment is concerned, our main focus is to have fit-for-purpose equipment available at the point of need. So our service delivery strategy is to make sure that we've got enough evidence to have the right equipment at the right place, that we look at the life cycle management. So from the time that you decide to buy equipment until the time that it can be disposed of, you've got a system in place to manage that. There are safe and appropriate use. Very often we find that our staff are the cause that equipment is damaged, and we work very hard to train them and care for our equipment. And then we work on maintenance programs. Our large or big ticket equipment always come with a maintenance contract of 5 years, and we then have got a maintenance program with clinical technologists helping us in that regard, and we've got an integrated system. So I'll not go into the detail, Honourable Chairperson. So I'm just going to look at what is the funding for services. It's 110 million and then 62 million, that's for medical equipment. And we procure it, the funding hospitals by themselves. And then for your health facility revitalization grant, our central department purchases, and those are usually your large, large equipment pieces that a hospital cannot buy. For example, a CT scanner it goes beyond 20 million rand, so not one single facility will be able to carry that, so we try to support them from the centre. So we've got in-house maintenance by clinical engineering workshops, and we're really fortunate. These are very, very scarce skills that we have across the three central hospitals. They work together. We don't have the full capacity. Every hospital, they're just too scarce. We just don't find that. So they work together, clinical engineers across Goodwood, Skeer, Tigerberg and Red Cross. We've got the provincial workshop in Goodwood. We've got some capability in our regional and large district hospitals. And the total staff for technicians and assistants are 64. So it doesn't sound a lot, but this is what we have, and the teams are working extremely hard to make sure that they maintain our equipment. And the complex equipment, as I've indicated, they are outsourced, and we've got maintenance contracts. Services challenge, always with more money you can do more, but the question is how can we do the best with what we've got? So there's replacement of aging equipment is a challenge. We have to select very carefully what do we replace and how do we replace. Increasing maintenance workload, which is a challenge, and then also operational management assets, which is also one of those challenges. Medical equipment, Chairperson, I'm not going to go through it. It just talks about how we sustain our service, how we improve our asset management, how we improve the maintenance. Then for infrastructure facilities management, Madam Chair, you would notice that in our budget allocation, we put much more focus on the maintenance of our existing facilities, our existing infrastructure, to increase the functional lifespan of those infrastructure. We also improve energy security and water security. There was a previous meeting, Madam Chair, that we presented to you on the drought situation and our responses on that. So we continue our work on the water security. We also reduce our utilization of medical gas. So all of these are saying, how can we do more with what we've got and yet maintain quality of care? So they just talks about what is the division of responsibility between us and the public works. So the second last bullet talks about what health is responsible for. And the last bullet talks about public works. And they are looking at the big capital works and the maintenance, scheduled maintenance in that regard. We've got two engineering workshops. We've got a third one at Lentegeer. And then we've got several approaches to maintenance and also the role of mobile workshops in terms of our response to maintenance needs. I think that's the same. Then we have service strategies to mitigate. We improve our capacity and our efficiency, our utilities management. So we've got a whole electronic system to monitor what is the water usage per bed, electricity usage per bed, gas usage per bed, and to see to what extent we can change the behavior of people in terms of water and electricity and other stuff. And at the bottom, Madam Chair, the Western Cape drought, we have briefed the committee. I'm not going to go in that detail again. Then laundry services. We keep a balance between in-house and outsourced service. We took a conscious decision not to outsource completely. This is just too a sensitive matter to be dependent on outside private provider for linen. It is too much part of the patient's experience. So we keep a balance between both of those capacities. So we have an industry capacity, geographical location, and we're looking at economic opportunities. We're looking at risk mitigation, especially in the cases of strikes. How do we respond when there are cases of strikes? And we also look at cost comparisons for assessing value for money. So the in-house service is 63% of the total service, and the outsourced service is 37%, and that serves 18 hospitals, and the in-house 21 hospitals. I'm not going to the detail. I think those are the most important points from those slides. This slide just gives you an indication what is the cost, and the particular slide that might be useful is that the in-house service costs are 66 million per year, and the average cost per piece is 5 rand. So whether it's a pillowcase or whatever, so this is on average, it costs us 5 rand to do the laundry. The outsourced service is 37% of the total. The total cost is 29.5 million, and the average cost per piece is 3 rand 80. So you can understand, Madam Chair, why we keep a balance between outsource and insource. It's about risk mitigation and make sure that we can give our patients linen when they need it. Our service challenges, we have got linen losses. 19.87% of losses in 2016-17 is quite significant, so we work very hard. And very often it's just wear and tear, the linen gets washed all the time, but we also have a pilferage. That is an issue. The cost of the in-house service is largely driven by salary wages, and then also the industry laundry equipment is very, very, very costly. And then the water, the drought has influenced our ability to use water. The strategies, we've got strategies to reduce linen losses. You can see the orders that we do. We're looking at radio frequency ID devices to see to what extent we can reduce linen losses. We reduce the in-house service, the goods and services cost items. We look at the efficient use of staff and logistics. In operations management, we look at industrial laundry equipment, and then the water, the drought. Again, Madam Chair, we spoke there on how can we use the water as efficient as possible. Then the management of healthcare waste. We've got a few principles there when we look at healthcare waste. It's very important that whoever there's a range, the value chain is quite extensive. And how do you make sure that the responsibilities are delineated appropriately, that we focus on occupational health and safety programs, that we do waste minimization and segregation, and that we develop and adopt safe and environmentally sound technologies. So we do have a policy framework for risk waste. We've used different technologies for treating the waste. We also, for example, are testing an in-house treatment in Khayelitsha Hospital to see to what extent we can reduce the quantum of waste that is both from an environmental perspective but then also from a cost perspective, that we can look at that. And we've got a total ban on mercury, and we are applying our systems also to that. I'm not going to go into detail, Madam Chair. The current is that we've got two service providers. There was a stage that we have only one, and we recognize the risk. So we've got our two service providers for the collection, for the removal, and then to sterilize and heat friction of our waste. And then we are planning to reduce costs more and to focus more on environmental friendly and responsible approach in waste management. I'm not going to go into detail there. Even this one, Madam Chair, you can look at the service challenges and the mitigations there. The planning and maintenance of infrastructure. What's important for us is when we plan infrastructure, we look at long life. What is the cycle of when we look at our infrastructure to also look at maintenance to make it as appropriate and as efficient as possible? Low impact. We've got a few facilities that are green registered as green buildings. We're looking at loose fit to be able to give us the flexibility when patients get more or service policies or priorities change. And we try to get luminous healing space. Patients just do better when there's more light in their place, in their facilities. And then also lean design and construction. This is just a repeat of what has already been presented in terms of the total infrastructure. What is important here is that the red part talks about the future for 2030. So it gives you an indication of where we would like to go to. Our planning is already in that space, and systematically we move from an infrastructure point of view in that direction as well. Our priorities in the metro and rural for hospitals is to modernize the emergency centers. That's our biggest pressure point. Psychiatric units, a big pressure point. Looking at fire compliance, looking at improving water and energy efficiencies, and also looking alternative water resources instead of municipal water. I think those are the most important lessons from that point, Madam Chair. Infrastructure, I think what we see on this slide is largely to say which facilities are in need of more attention. And your higher condition facilities, we only need preventive maintenance, is C5, and those facilities that are beyond repair. You can see it's a health facility beyond repair, it must be replaced, that's 1%. So most of them are in the C2, C3, C4 scale of the condition of those facilities. Capital projects completed in 2017-18, Madam Chair, that is only for your own information. Planned activities in the medium to long term just show what we would like to do, and you can see a lot of this is in the hospital space. And the second one I know that is of quite importance for the committee is that we are replacing Gerfjuster with the Klipfontein Regional Hospital, and that is already quite advanced in the planning phase. We've got the challenges, Madam Chair, that the maintenance backlog at the moment, according to our calculations, is more than 1 billion rand. It is a big challenge, and our collective responsibility between us and Public Works is how do we respond to that. And you can see that when we look at the budget allocation, it's about 50-50 for new capital and for maintenance. And I'm not going to go into the details further in that slide. The drought, Madam Chair, we have had this presentation. It's just show that the department is challenged by drought, by extreme climate events and other disasters like fires. We had a lot of challenges that come our way. We've got our service strategies in how to challenge the maintenance backlog, how to look at infrastructure replacement, how to look at the drought. All of those have then mitigation strategies available. Our central hospitals, Tygerberg Hospital, Dr. Kluti mentioned that Tygerberg Hospital is under severe pressure. Of our acute hospitals, the hospital with the largest pressure that it's experiencing. Yet it's also the hospital with the largest maintenance backlog, massively. The CSIR assessed hospitals say the hospital must be replaced. So we are working towards that direction. We had a feasibility study for the replacement done, but we are spending at the moment, this year alone, let me put it, over the past few years we've spent 700 million just on the maintenance of that hospital, and when you walk through the hospital you can't see it because it's sewage lines, it's water lines, it's gas lines. That hospital really need replacement, the bill at the moment is about 10 billion rand to replace just the tertiary part of the hospital, and we are motivating with the national department to assist us financially to replace that hospital. Then, Madam Chair, you asked about financial systems. I will not go into a lot of detail here, but just to say that we've developed a few budget management tools. The first is a budget management instrument. And it's an instrument where on a monthly basis our CFO provides every hospital and every sub-district with detailed information of what have they spent money on, how far are were they spending, and what the risks are, and then the services in the hospitals must respond and indicate what their plans are to remain in budget and to make sure that we still achieve our goals. The second circle there is approved post lists. So staff costs is about 65% of the total cost of the budget of this department. So unless you control staff numbers, you're not going to control your costs. So there's an approved post list. So every CEO sign off on the post that they may fill for the year. And then the whole system is then geared to make sure that we assist the CEOs to take decisions in that space. And then the financial monitoring committees that happens at every level, but then also at the central level, that's part of our monitoring and accountability structures. I'm not going to detail this, just explains what does the BMI do and how it works, and how does the APL does and how it works. This is also captured in the NHI white paper, and we were very proud that the white paper took some lessons from the Western Cape in that regard. The FMCs, I don't want to go in detail there, and these are all the IT systems, Madam Chair. We were not sure what the questions would be, but we've listed all the systems there. I'm not going to go in detail, but that is then for the committee to consider. Mm-hmm. Then on information technology, Dr. Balachi will handle that part.
So on information technology, what the department has done is, clearly this is a very important space, a lot of expectations, very dynamic, a lot of developments taking place, and we realize that it's important that we have a long-term vision of this space in terms of information systems. So we developed that vision, and the document is available should the committee wish it. It's about 30, 40 pages long. But then what we did is we extracted the essence into a one page, and it looks like this, and we can make the one page available, which is really high level, just defining what the problem statement is, identifying what are the what is the vision, what are the principles, and then what are some of the main strategic initiatives in this area, and what are the enablers to make this happen. So that's available for the committee. Then in the space, like I said, because this is a complex and dynamic field and lots of developments actually happening, we asked ourselves, how does one develop a set of hooks to actually think about this, some kind of framework to think about this? So what you see here is, in the center, those very big pillars in this space, and then the arrows that come off it is trying to hook all the kind of developments to these pillars. But the big point here is that information and data and IT systems is not an end in itself. It's really a means for us to improve our efficiency and effectiveness and service delivery. So whatever we're doing in this space must be responsive to patient care and service delivery. And it's important that we remind ourselves about that all the time. So if you just very quickly from the bottom, if you take IT infrastructure, we are dependent on our partners, which in this province is CEI, that resides in Dot B in the office of the Premier, that's largely responsible for connectivity and IT infrastructure in the province. Okay, so we have to work closely with our partners. IT hardware is really about procuring the computers and the printers and that kind of thing, so that's another area. And there are we have a five-year cycle at which we aim to replace our IT hardware, and clearly there are backlogs, but we put about 10 million rands a year behind this, but that doesn't keep up with the backlogs that are mounting. Then as far as IT software systems go, on the left-hand side is a range of core systems. So if you ought to think about this as the spine of the department, right? These are the kind of key systems in primary healthcare, in our hospitals, in pharmacy, in imaging, and ECCR is an electronic discharge system. Right? On the right-hand side, you see a lot of developments taking place, and I'm not going to take you through each of those, but in a variety of spaces, from community-based services to bed bureaus to referral systems, there's work taking place about developing applications or systems to modernize and to make work lighter. Okay. Information systems capability. I think one of the things is, for many years, IT used to do its thing on the side. Okay, and we've realized that it is such an important enabler to the core business of the department that we've started to mainstream IT. So we need to bring IT into the planning of the department, into the budgeting of the department, into the M&E of the department, into the governance arrangements of the department. So we've created a set of governance structures, and to send a signal of how important this area is, the top structure is an IT steercom, which the HOD chairs. Okay? So that's important, and then we also have a bilateral between our HOD and the HOD or CEI, so that if there are problems and there are barriers, then it gets escalated this, to this level. You can't separate the IT systems from data, because one of the key products of information systems is data and how that gets used. So the whole area of data governance is also receiving a lot of attention. And in this province, we've been fortunate to develop a data center. Okay, and we have a unique identifier in this province. We've been working with that for a couple of decades now. And the importance of that is that unique identifier enables us to track patients across the entire system. Okay. So if a patient went to a primary healthcare clinic, or went to a TB hospital, or went to Krotoski, that unique identifier is able to give us that information about that patient across the platform. Okay. Now the data center also uses that unique identifier number to pull data from the laboratory system. It pulls data from the radiology system. So we are able to compile quite a rich picture about every individual patient in the system. Okay? So if I gave you an example, if we took women suffering from cervical cancer, okay, we could have data from this system that tells us how many women that came into the system had a pap smear. Of those that had a pap smear, how many were actually found positive? Of those that were found positive, how many were actually referred for colposcopy, which is another level of a procedure in a specialized hospital. Of those that had a positive colposcopy, how many were put on treatment? Right? And then lastly, of those that had cervical cancer, how many have passed on? So you are able to develop a profile of patients in the system from beginning to end. And I think that's quite a powerful mechanism down to individual patient level. Okay? So that's work in progress, and we've done quite well on that, and we've been engaging with our national colleagues around a similar system to get systems to talk to each other. Okay. And then from a governance point of view, we have internal arrangements, and then we have external arrangements with our partners. I then want to move on to risk management, because that was the other area that we were asked to comment on. So as far as the department goes, we have 7 departmental strategic risks, which are in our APP, and those are budget constraints, staff-related security incidents, stockouts of essential pharmaceutical goods, fraud, service delivery pressures, water shortage, and aging infrastructure and health technology. And Madam Chair, I'm not going to go through the detail of the mitigation strategies, but for each of these, the mitigation strategies are listed, and we have already discussed some of them. For example, the staff-related security incidents was covered by Dr. Kluti in the EMS space. That's a big area. The pharmaceuticals I've covered earlier on under that section, etc. But that's information available to the committee. Then just to say, as far as risk management goes, the department has a risk champion, which the Chief Director of Strategy and Health Support has been deemed the risk champion. There's a departmental risk committee that is fully functional, meets quarterly. There are risk owners that have been designated for each of those risks that I've been that I mentioned, and a risk record is completed every quarter by the risk owners, and then the risk committee assesses that, scores that, whether it's extreme, high, moderate, or low, assesses them against likelihood and impact, and then from that process, a report is tabled at our top management meeting as well as the audit committee. Going one level down, the program managers, the budget program managers, are responsible for risk at that level, and we're deepening this process as we go. The next area is security services. So in the main, security services are outsourced in this department, and these are through contracts at facility level. We also have about 90 in-house security level security staff. They are largely in the central hospitals. We have a very close working relationship, and we have a formal MOU with the Department of Community Safety, who assists us in managing this interface. And some of the kind of high-risk areas as far as security goes, is there are pockets in the province where gang violence is quite high, and that often has implications for us in the services, EMS hijackings and incidents. Psychiatric patients in emergency centers is also a challenging area. Dr. Engelbrecht mentioned that we are trying to modernize our ECs and we're trying to modernize psychiatric units, but the truth of the matter is in many instances we have old infrastructure and we're often managing these patients together, and that's quite complex. And then the last one is service protests from time to time also poses a risk. The next slide just gives you a snapshot of the types of incidents, and we just took April 1 month and just given you an indication of what are the kinds of incidents we capture. So from abscondments, and again these are largely in the psychiatric space, to damage to property, theft, threatening behavior, verbal abuse, etc. The last slide here just gives you an indication comparing the same month over 2 years. So April 2017 versus April 2018, and it gives you, and in the red you can see there's been a slight increase in the incidents in this year. So that brings to a conclusion my section. Thank you, Chair.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. That concludes our presentation.
No, thank you. Thank you very much, the MSC, for the presentation from the Western Cape. We will then now ask questions. And well, I need not school you. You will understand that questions will be asked by honorable members, and then you will see how you respond to them. We have been joined by two persons that it will be important that we know where they are coming from. And you have to introduce yourself.
Good morning, I'm Tamar Khan from Business Day Newspaper.
Hi, morning. My name is Rebecca Moore from Women on Farms Project.
From?
Women on Farms Project.
Yes. Marlene Lawrence, Chief Coordinator at Parliament.
And at the back, we have also been joined by one of our co-staff, Asanda, the researcher to the study group of the African National Congress. Thank you very much. Honorable members, there is a presentation, questions, want to, Honorable Wilson, Honorable Mabanga, Honorable Nkonzo, Honorable Maisele. For now, that is the group, that is the... Okay, Honorable Wilson.
Thank you, Chair. In actual fact, the question I have is not necessarily related directly to your presentation, but it does deal with audit outcomes. And if we could get some indication from the department, please, on the outcomes with regards to your fruitless and wasteful and irregular expenditures. When we're dealing with budgets and you've got so many constraints and infrastructures under stress and that kind of thing, it's not quite nice to just get in a comparison of one against the other, I thank you.
Sorry. Your name, please? Yes. And you know why I'm asking you as you come? It's your comment, which I'm not going to tell them, that I read from your lips.
I'm Colleen Smart. I'm the media liaison officer for the MEC, the MEC Mama French and Wombo.
I couldn't pick up your name.
Colleen Smart.
Thanks, Chair, and greeting to the House.
Chair, yesterday we had an opportunity to meet with the Office of the Healthy Standard Compliance. In their report, they've stated very clear that provinces have not improved performance compared to the compared to their baseline audits. So the question is, how is the province, your province in fact, your department in this province, Western Cape, dealing with the OHSC's finding in the province? Are any changes being implemented after maybe you have read the findings from the Office of the Healthy Standard Compliance? Then secondly, on the issue of the oncology, please describe in details the function of the oncology service in the province. Now on slide 18 and 19, I've seen there we have spoken to some strategies, which I believe your strategies for improving patients' experience of care is very impressive. But my question, how soon do you envisage their implementation? Do you feel that the third point towards fixing staff attitudes would suffice, or shouldn't there be other avenues to explore, such as finding out if the practitioners still feel at home within the healthy sector? And migrating to slide, to page 46, where it relates to patient transport. The report stated that Healthy Net within metros is being reviewed, and it is its impact on inter-facility transfers will impact on freeing up ambulances and their response time. My question is, when can we expect a detailed report on the review? Again, moving to slide 48, where it relates to the referral system. On your last bullet, the department is putting mechanism in place to implement electronic referral. The question is, when will the mechanism to implement electronic referral system start to function? Lastly, Chair, on page 68, on your main challenges there, what mitigation plans could work to curb the challenges faced by the program, such as the following: impact of increase in public sector wage bill, budget pressure, limit filling of posts, staff safety, and intractable service pressures? I submit, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. just wanted to find out about irregular and unauthorized fruitless and wasteful expenditure. If details could be provided of each in the province and the program of action to provide detail to eradicate the practice or this practice in the province. That's one. And number two, qualified graduates. The department, whether I just want to check if the department used the graduates and intends to improve financial services. On slide 53, where mention is made of the NPOs and where's slide 53? Excuse me. I just wanted to get to know the spread of the NPOs and the distribution of the workers thereof. And then we have a slide that refers to I think it's slide 65. Is it? Yeah, it is slide 65. SMS profile. We have an analysis and a spread there about females, males, African, colors, etc. Maybe we should also add female and males with respect to the disabled. Maybe if we could just get some info in that regard. And a slide about ambulance attacks. After January, there seems to be a decrease in the number of attacks. January, it was very high, 11. And in May, it went up to 12. After February, March, April, etc., they were not so high. It looks like something was done about it before the statistics of May. Was that as a result of the arrests? Or if yes, were there any convictions relating to that? I think that's it, Chair, on my side. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. We all know that the greatest driver of ill health is poverty, and we know that poverty seems to consign people to a specific areas and concentrate them there, and they are packed there and almost hidden and forgotten. And somebody mentioned very interesting thing that when you are a visitor here, coming from the airport, the first thing you see is abject poverty and those sheds. think maybe that's an indictment on all of us that is still happening. And you see, it's no use treating people in the hospital, fix them and send them back to the conditions that brought them to the hospital in the first place. It's a waste of money and effort and life, because eventually they will die. So there are certain things that need to be combated before we can even try to give people medication. It's a waste, unless it's a business that they are customers, and if you fix them up, they won't come back and you lose your bottom line, your profit. So, you see, when you hide people behind the mountain and they don't see what is happening on the other side, they are suspicious. You know, what is happening on the other side? Like if you build a wall, your neighbors will always suspect that you must be doing something not good, something very bad in your yard, and they will always try to peek and see what is happening there. And I think we all know what I'm talking about, right? So I think all said and done, if we can concentrate on this one thing, just this one thing, and do it right, it looks like maybe you, according to your document, you are doing everything right, except the right thing. Okay, you're doing everything right and correctly, except the right thing. So if we can do the right thing right, the rest will follow. But the rest maybe, the question now become academic. I don't know whether I have the luxury of just asking them for the sake of academic exercise. Okay. Because what I wanted to say, I've said. So maybe I should just ask them, maybe for academic purposes. We said that there is a people-centered government or people-centered care. What does this actually mean? I mean, we're supposed to be caring for people, but if it's people-centered care, just discovered, I don't understand what it means. Maybe it could be explained to me, then I'll understand what it means. Universal health coverage, does it mean NHI? Or there is another universal health coverage outside of NHI? Maybe there is another system that we are not aware of. How many clinics have clinical committees? Are all clinics having clinical committees? Now, you say that there is a positive change of the story of people in the Western Cape. May we have the original story so that we can compare as to what you have changed it to? No, this new story, because if it's just a new story, there is no old story. We won't be able to know which story we are talking about. So let's get that maybe. The rest I can skip. What is the total population of Cape Town, of Cape Province? Because there is 14 million mentioned, and then there is some headcount, and so on and so on, and 4.1 million. If we can get that, then we have an idea of what we are dealing with here. Is there is something on page 18 mentioning poor service delivery, but complaints. Then on the same page is excellent care and professionalism, professional care. So it's contradictory type of statements on the one page. We're supposed to have insourcing of services as a mandatory policy, but it looks like it's not the policy type is modified to suit certain circumstances. I thought policy is policy and it must be carried out unless there is a special exemption because of special motivation that we cannot carry out the policy because of this and this. We are still asking for some time to put our house in order. Policy is policy. So you can't do it half. There is no half dead people. If people are dead, they are dead. Maybe half dead is on the road to death. They are not yet dead. So let's sort that one out. Now, there is also another policy of transformation. There are nice figures here. 30% blacks, 15% white, 5% color, 2% Indians, of what? And we, how many, we're talking about executive transformation here. The rest you can have 100% black people, like we have 51% women. I mean, maybe it means nurses. There are always more nurses than doctors in the health facility. So if you count them all and you have 5 doctors and 50 nurses and say it's transformation, hey, it has a lot to say. Can we get the right figures at the executive level, whether it's been transformed or it's not been transformed? Yeah, like I said, the rest will just be academic things. And I don't want to get into that thing.
Honorable Kopana, Honorable Adams, then the last one for Honorable Mashale, in that order.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for the presentation. Firstly, I just want to echo the words of you, Chairperson, and the MEC, when saying that the intention today is not maybe to destroy you, but the reality is we need to talk about what is really affecting you so that we can fix it. Because the problem for the Western Cape is a problem of all South African people. And, Chair, having the opportunity yesterday to listen to the presentation by the Office of Health Standards and Compliance, and having the opportunity also to have the report of the Auditor General, your report, your annual report, it clearly shows that South Africa, our healthcare system, is having problems. Despite that we had a qualified report, there are still challenges. Yesterday, according to the Office of Health Standard Compliance, there are certain findings that they mention. In their findings, it's about patients' rights, safety, most of the things that you presented today, that they need really attention. So I just want to find out from you, in terms of the findings of the Office of the Health Standard Compliance, did you manage to go through the report where the highlighted issues, maybe they have engagement with you? Do you have a plan? How are you going to resolve this identified issue? Because some of them are just short term, others are long term. Did maybe you have the like costing of how to address certain issues because they are here? So that is my first question. Something that also triggered me, Chair, I just want to talk about the community health workers. I realize, according to the presentation, you are working with about 90 NPOs, of which they are having about 3,700 community workers. Most of the time, those are the people who are really our soldiers that are really helping us, but sometimes government fail to look after such people. I just want to find out, this community health workers, are they linked to the health facilities? There is a proper supervision or monitoring by the professional people? Sometimes they are not necessarily well mentored, because to deal with many people who doesn't understand the health, it's not anybody who can be a health person. So you also need other people to look after you. So is there any program that maybe is in place also to look after their well-being, health, wellness? That is what I want to know. The other thing with regard to community health workers, social development is also tend to do the same program. I just want to find out their relationship with the social development. How are you working together? Because sometimes there's a lot of duplication of which we can save money. So that is the thing that I want to know. According to a patient to seven, the
the vacancy rate or the HR, you, if maybe you can clarify to us, I do see that your vacancy rate is 4.5, but the highest, you mentioned the program, why program sickness is a problem, but if maybe you can clarify the nature of appointments that you excluded in terms of seasonal doctors or whatever, if maybe you can explain thoroughly to us what is the implication or what is happening. In terms of the vacancy rate, do you have any, is there any moratorium that is in place or what is happening, if maybe you can explain that to us? Chair, I think I'll stop there because whatever that they've said today is exactly what the Office of Standards that they were saying to us, that really there are critical things that we need to talk about that need attention from all of us. And we're really looking forward to assist any province that is coming before us, you know, being open about their problems, because we have to assist you guys. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Honorable Kopana, Honorable Adams.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you to the Department of the Western Cape.
Sorry, Honorable Adams, I was going to say I would appreciate if members can try and speak to the mic because of this disturbance of what is happening outside.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you to the Department of the Western Cape for the presentation. Chair, I will refer to certain pages. Page 6, Governance and Leadership. Lack of stability in senior management has been highlighted as a major factor in poor performance in provincial departments. How long has the MEC head of department, chief financial officer of other senior management staff been in place? And also on page 6, the AG found that slow response by leadership and senior management is a root cause for audit findings. How does the province leadership and management deal with the AG's findings? Are there regular follow-up meetings to determine if correct measures have been implemented? And on page 77, infrastructure planning, a number of issues were raised concerning planning of infrastructure, including poor planning and project management. How are infrastructure needs determined and prioritized in your province? Are feasibility studies been done? And the next one, Chair, is on page 53 on the community health workers. They explained how the community workers are work. My question is, how are visits of the community health workers being monitored? Is there a register system? I thank you.
Honorable Mashari.
No, thanks, Chair. Let's welcome the the comprehensive presentation by the provincial department. Well, to start with, Chair, I'll start with the governance and leadership. I didn't get exactly what are the challenges on governance and leadership, and what are the solutions to those challenges. I'm raising this in the context of what other members have raised around the observation made by the Office of the Health Compliance Standards around governance and leadership. There's a whole range of issues that have raised around governance and leadership, which are a deficiency that they've noted. One would have then have expected the the province to then say, we've got these deficiencies and these are the mitigating factors that we're putting in place to deal with those challenges around governance and leadership, of which they mention a large number of them: oversight, accountability, there's some challenges, strategic management, there's some challenges that they've identified, etc., etc. So it will have been good to understand what are the governance challenges from your own perspective, and what then are you putting in place to deal with those governance challenges from your own perspective. And then the other issue that I just want to raise is that just want to understand your relation with the Metro healthcare services, because according to Office of the Health Compliance Standards, that's where the majority of your primary health care facilities are located, and they are not doing very well. And there's been an argument about whether they are properly funded, because it's not the core business or the core mandate of the municipalities. So what becomes the relationship that governs the health provision at that level vis-a-vis yourselves, and how do you assist then? What plans do you intend putting in place to assist the Metro to be able to lift up the standards of healthcare in their jurisdiction? Because the observation by the Office of the Health Standards that it is very poor. It's not at the required standard. And that's the biggest portion of your primary health care that is located as a province. And then the issue that we've identified as a way of improving the patient experience of care, that is the care and professional treatment, your waiting times and staff attitude, etc. You've listed the issues that you want to, strategies that you are putting in place. Just to get an understanding, how are you going to, because I've not seen at the end, how are you going to monitor and evaluate the outcomes of these strategies? Because once you put strategies, there must be a system of monitoring and evaluating so that they're able to see whether it's making the intended results. And then how do you deal with the self-assessment vis-a-vis the Office of the Health Compliance Standards? I'm raising this because your self-assessment is very excellent. Says that no, you are doing extraordinary very well. But the Office of the Health Compliance Standards, when they were presenting the report yesterday, there was only one hospital, or about two hospitals, if I'm not mistaken, that were conditionally compliant with 60 to 69% performance. But here you've got 81, 88, there's not even a single one that is below 70. All of them, they're above But in the health compliance standard, there is no one that is above 70. How do you relate the two, so that you don't have your own self-assessment that make you to remain in a comfort zone and said, no, we're doing very well, while the Office of the Health Compliance, based on the same national cost standards, they are saying, no, you're not doing very well. So that you, I would have expected you to be more critical of yourself more than the Office of the Health Compliance Standards, and therefore rate yourself much more lower so that you are able to put more efforts to improve, rather than rating yourself very high and then you remain on a comfort zone to say, no, we're doing fine, pretty well. That goes to a clinic. I'm not sure whether this ideal clinic includes those that are in the metros, because as I've indicated, the Office of the Health Compliance Standard is saying that it's doing extremely very bad. All the metro clinics in the country, with Cape Town's metro included. And then you, for example, you are at 59%, almost 60% of ideal clinic in the province. Does that include the one in the metro? Because there's no one in the metro that is said to be doing very well, according to the Office of the Health Compliance Standards records. Because they've got 106 that are ideal. And how do you relate to what is ideal in your own perspective and the national department's perspective vis-a-vis what the Office of the Health Compliance Standard is saying around the performance of clinics? Because they're the worst performing in the whole country. Clinics and community hospitals are looking by much more better. But clinics are worse off in the whole country, Western Cape included. But you have got almost 60% of your clinics that are ideal. How do you correlate the two reports of ideal vis-a-vis the reports from the Office of the Compliance Standard? So that we reach from the same page. You don't have a situation where you said you are ideal, you have arrived, and then things are fine. And then the Office of the Health Compliance Science says, no, you are not doing very well. You are performing badly. And then we don't know now which one do we take to be realistic. In relation to what is expected of all of us. And then coming to TB management, so just to get an indication whether you do have defaulters, what is the defaulting rate, because we have not indicated whether there is a defaulting, because there should be people who are defaulting. And what is the defaulting rate in the province as a whole, so that we understand the extent to which you are managing this sketch properly. On the community health workers, there was a debate about community health workers having to be absorbed by the state. What is your position on this matter? Because you'll recall at some point I said there's still a debate and discussions between provinces and national coming up with the policy of absorption, And then our understanding is that that policy has been adopted. And what is the position of the province in relation to that matter? And then coming to the issue of medicine, I'll just go to the Auditor General's report. There was a performance audit that was conducted by the Auditor General, and there's some findings that were made, of which one of them was around stock management system at medical depot, which were outdated and not used optimally at some point. And Western Cape was one of the provinces that was found to be wanting around that area. That includes poor storage practices at health institutions, as well as stock management records, in terms of accurate or incomplete records. But what is the current situation around this, all these issues that the AG raised when they were doing the performance audit, which I'm sure it was presented at your disposal by the AG's office to be able to begin to address those issues? How far are you? Have you able to resolve those matters? And then on your slide 66, unfortunately we are not sure, we don't, because the programs, we only know national programs, you see. We don't know your programs. So you've written program 1, 2, 3, until to 8. We don't know what those programs. I can only guess that program 1 is administration. But I won't guess what is the rest. Because I know the national program 1 is administration, so I can only guess that it's also administration on your side. And national program 2, it's national health insurance, and I don't think it is in your side. So I will not know the program, so that we understand. My interest is more on primary health care program. So I want to know where does it fall, you see, so that I understand exactly how is this, because normally when we engage with the national department around the budget, that program, which is program 4 in the national department, primary health care, has got the smallest budget. And we're told, the bulk of the budget is only equitable share, which is in provinces. And therefore, we'll be more interested to understand what is the share of which program is this, is primary health care, and what is the share of that program in the total budget of the department, and what percentage does it represent, so that at least we've got an understanding whether the worry that we normally have with the national department should not be a worry at all, because we're told no, primary health care, it's fully funded at the provincial level. And then coming to human resource, Chair. The indication is that just the terminology for me, because the terminologies we are using interchangeable, which sometimes create confusion. I don't know what is it now. But somewhere where we are talking about 53%, yeah. Where you are talking about 30% are blacks, 15% white, 53% are colored, 52% are Indians. And then you go to your slide 65, where you deal with the SMS profile. You then change and talk about African. It can't mean one and the same thing. It can't mean one and the same thing. African and black. It can't be used interchangeably and mean one and the same thing. And therefore, they should be consistent in the usage of the term. Our own understanding is that the one that you use on SMS are the correct one. Where you are saying Africans, male and female combined, it's your 43. Is it what? Not sure what I mean. Let me not talk of the figures. I'm tired because here is black and white. I'm confusing it when I was looking at my laptop, where it was clear. Here is black and white, so I will not see. I don't know which one is which is which here, because it's one and the same thing, unfortunately. But the clarification. It makes it much more easier when you categorize it in the manner that you did in that pie, compared to what we've written there. So there must be some element of consistency so that we're able to have the same interpretation at the end of the day. And then the laundry services. I understand that you are saying the implication that we are making is that it's more cost effective when you use the private than the insourcing in terms of cost. But I would have loved a situation where you don't just limit to cost, but you also go to quality of service, so that you are able then to have a proper quantification, the quality of service, as well as the challenge that you have in terms of the linen being lost, so that you are able to quantify where is the loss, the biggest loss. Is it in the in-source or is it in the private? And what are the causes on both sides? So that we've got a better, because there might be high loss in the in-sourcing side, which might reflect on the management problem. Because if there is no proper management system, things are bound to collapse and in that way. So that we are able to understand the totality of the picture around insourcing vis-a-vis your private. And then the financial management system, that goes to the same way as I would have thought that you are going to indicate the supply chain processes. Because when you look at what the Office of the Health Compliance Standards raising as deficiency on supply chain, some of them are very essential things, like your monitoring of event records that they could not find. And then the assets register of items that are disposed could not be located. And then there was a minimum or maximum, some reorder of evidence of stock taking that were not could not be located, and lot of things that they are raising under that supply chain processes, and even the AG in the report on pharmaceutical performance there were delays on the supply, which were identified by the AG during the performance audit on pharmaceutical. Do you still experience that delay nationally? Because the contract is mainly national, as you have reported. Do you still experience the delay that the AG has? Because some of them were even 90 days, some of them are 120 days. And what becomes the implication if that happens? But you still experience that, so that if you still do, and then we're able to understand it, so we're able to engage the national department to understand why are they appointing service provider that are unable to provide the service timely as required. And they were found, some of them not even being penalized for the delay. They delay, you make an order, they delay, but there are no penalties that gets... So this become business as usual for them, because there's no penalty. But when you don't pay yourself on time, they penalize you. But when they don't deliver on time, you don't penalize them. Is that still the situation, or there's been improvement around this area? And then on the, I'm going towards the end, the last chain. On the security services, there's something very interesting. I thought you will explain why. We are saying high risk. And one of the highest risk is psychiatric patient in the Eastern Cape. I thought EC means Eastern Cape. Oh, imagine centers. Okay. No, I was worried. Why are psychiatric patients from the Eastern Cape? Risk, high risk. Oh, okay. What have you find to be the reason behind the hijacking of ambulances? What do they want? I don't understand it. Why do they want the ambulance? Or do they? Or what is there in the ambulance that can be used by people? Just to have an understanding, because I'm trying to understand it. I'm not unable to understand what is it that could be the main reason. What is that they want? And then, lastly, Chair, going back to the pharmaceutical issues, the management status, there was an Auditor General's report sometimes a year or so again, where it found that all provinces, all of them without exception, pharmaceutical systems were not integrated among pharmacies, the depot and the hospitals. What is the situation now in your situation? The other findings was that not all modules within the systems were used. It was only Free State and Northern Cape that was able to do that. What is the situation now? And then the last one around the key findings on the pharmaceutical system by the AG was that trends analysis was not undertaken at the facilities to optimally manage pharmaceuticals. What is the situation now as we speak around this area of work? Has there been any improvement or was still dealing with it? Then under waste management. One of the issues that the AG found was around compliance with NEMA and NEMWA. I just want to have an understanding, how far are you with that? Because you are one of those that in terms of healthcare waste was not stored at the required container separate from the other waste. And then the other issue that was already observed around waste was the healthcare waste not transported in the required manner to prevent spillage or littering. And then the last one was the healthcare waste disposed in a manner that is likely to cause pollution of the environment or harm. So those were the issues that were found by the AG around waste management. What is there any improvement? Have you come up with new measures and system to intervene on the waste? Because when you were presenting under waste management, I could not find the extent to which these things are being addressed in your presentation. Thanks, Chair.
No, thank you very much, honorable members. Just some few questions from myself. I think one has been asked, but in a different way. The system in terms of tracking TB defaulters right across. You say you are being donated medicine. By whom? Who's donated? Yeah, in your presentation. I would appreciate if in terms of which is your slide page 75, you are referring to the challenges in relation to equipment. But equipment in the health sector starts from a pneumometer. I'm just making. Is it possible for you to identify which are those equipment that you have got problems? I'm going to page so that I'm able to, because I've noted that. Medical equipment. You said you do have some challenges there. Which are those? So that we have got a broader understanding. You may have problems in equipment. Maybe you are worse off than Gauteng. I'm just making an example. So if you are general in terms of challenges in relation to equipment, let me see. Personally, I will have a problem. You have, in terms of finances, you have not reflected on procurement. Are you doing good? Do you have challenges in relation to what Honorable Mahlalela was saying? As I was looking into the report, is that listening to the presentation, it's really more, you are more commending yourselves. On page 118, in terms of the insourcing and outsourcing, you do mention, as you are presenting, that the outsourcing the insourcing is more on central hospitals. Where is the outsourcing located? That is page 18. Under security services, Number one, in the main, security services are outsourced and managed through contract levels. And in two, which is about insourcing, you do mention insourcing, where is insourcing? But in terms of outsourcing, you are not reflecting which institution. You just said in two, you mentioned Central Hospital. That's what made me to be more curious. Now, where is the outsourcing? Because we are to know where is the outsourcing. Page 17. When I once attended the what is this committee that is dealing with money, they said if there is one line item that is not acceptable, it's others. On page 17, where you have got a table on, sorry for that, yes, complaints and compliments. You have got a line item under, just next after the name, which is others. Which are those? Because they're quite a, past 184, what are those others? Is mine, you know that I've been calling, I call you from time to time. Do I fall under that? That's on a lighter note, but on a more serious note, that will be. There are three issues that have been in the public domain. I'm going to be, should I say opportunistic, that you are here and raise those. One, it has been in the, it was on the media, a patient MEC that went missing, alleged, you said it was discharged, and that patient was found decomposed in one of your, what is happening there? I'm saying that you are here. Let me take that opportunity. Two, is the issue about the Joestar, what really is happening there? To have communication with communities so that we really do understand. Because when they communicate, when they pick up a phone and say, yeah, look, one, we don't have that full information. It will be important that you are here. We take that opportunity. Take us through what is the challenge in terms of that situation. Tiger Beck. I'm saying Tiger Beck because I pick up that you really want Tiger Beck to be, should I say, revamped or being demolished and rebuilt. But you are not reflecting on that when Tiger Beck was built. I'm raising this because I want to put with Livingston Hospital. When Tiger Beck was built at a particular time, the population was not as it is now. So that's why the infrastructure will then have a problem. Do you think that in really demolishing Tiger Beck will be a cost effective in the challenges that the country is having in terms of money? I mean, I'm looking into Tiger Beck. We're not talking about a small institution. We're talking about a huge institution here. Where do you think the resources are going to come from? I'm raising this because if you remember, at a particular time when we were in appropriations, you said there is a X amount of money that you are then going to allocate for refurbishment of Tiger Beck. But today we are talking about demolishing Tiger Beck. So that's where my question is coming from. That do you really think that is a possible and is going to assist? The last for this round is from myself, is that I was called and I said, oh, in fact, I've been trying to check where can I get. There's a serious allegation that you have stopped training of I'm saying it's an allegation. I will give you the number of the a parent that I have been referred to. An allegation that as the Western Cape has stopped training nurses, and you are saying, I'm saying it's an allegation, HOT. You are saying it's an instruction that you are getting from National Department. So in me giving you, I'll give you that, what is it? Is there a communication that is not being understood by communities? My understanding is that training is in a cycle. It's a process of being done in a cycle. But from 2016 to 2018, what is it that maybe this person doesn't understand? So that's why I'm saying I'm going to give you the contact number, but I think that it is important that I raise it here so that if then there is a misunderstanding, you also clear that with ourselves that no, there is a misunderstanding. I'm raising it because this allegation that says it's an instruction that you are getting from the National Department, and I'm finding it very strange. The last one is that, should I say you are patting your back on information, how you, my ID number, and when, if I understood you well, say, if I go to Khayelitsha, if you are one of those provinces that are implementing it, because that is a National Department program in terms of addressing the challenges that we're having on how we manage information of patients. Is it your pilot that you have done on your own as a department? Or you are a province that have then implemented that in a manner that is more, so make us to understand, so that we are then able to say to the National Department of Health, there is a case that go and draw lessons from the Western Cape, or we are able to say, well, the Western Cape has managed to do what you think that is the best, and how then do we ensure that? I'm raising that because I was listening to you attentively, sir, when you said that you've done this, but my understanding, I was patiently waiting to say, in relation to the program of the National Department of Health, in as far as managing the patient information, this is what we have managed. I think Honorable Mahlalela and the others have reflected on the Office of Health and Compliance, which you are not putting yourselves in a picture that says here we are not, that is, we are not doing well. And I want to say, MEC and HOD, as I was listening, maybe I'm not the only one, as I was looking into this, is this a presentation that was done to the portfolio committee in the legislature? Or is something, I'm raising that precisely because program one, program two, and how am I going to know that? Because we are not in that space. We understand that that's where at some point you present your APP. We'll get responses from you, and then we will comment at the end on. But thank you very much. What we will do, we'll give you space to respond, and then we will then who is going to respond on what? It's what we have said. We are going to be here until we break for lunch, so that I don't forget this. When we come back, honourable members, we will be on M315. We're not coming back here after lunch. Gauteng will meet it at M314, precisely because of what is happening outside. But can we then break? Bali, where are we getting our lunch? Here or at 1? Our lunch will be at 1. But for now, let's allow the Western Cape to just 5 minutes in sorting yourselves, then we come back and respond on the questions that have been asked by members. Thank you very much. You are going to tell us when you are ready.
No, no, sorry, we're asking that the allocation, what time are you allocating us to respond for how long?
Let me see.
No, because we don't want to go on one thing yet. Probably, let's say we have got 2 hours. Probably, maybe for us, we are preparing for 4 hours. That's what I'm trying to highlight, so that we can be able to know. Because there have been, like I was counting now, the questions were over 80. So that's why I wanted just to see where do we have to prioritize, so that they don't say cut off now.
When we give a presenter's time to sort themselves, it's precisely because when you were listening to questions, you are better placed to say this question, we can club it with this one and this one. Two, we have never been prescriptive and give people time. If we feel that we have not been responded to, we will. So I'm just trying to say, prepare yourselves. We will indicate if some of the responses you are not you won't be able to respond to on them now. You will want us to give you time to follow them up in terms of written questions to the secretariat of the committee. That is fine. So I'm not quite sure in terms of asking what time. We've never been asked, maybe that's the thing. We've never been asked what time do you give us to for response. Can I just request that we just leave it there? When we come, if you want to sensitize me during break to say it is fine, but I'm not going to commit the question, the committee now to say we're giving you 30 minutes, we're giving you an hour. But we will appreciate the responses, and we'll appreciate if some of the responses you're not going to be able to give us now. Then we will then say we're giving you this time to come back. Written questions, that's what we always allow presenters to do, whether department, whether entities, whether provinces. I hope I have faith.
No, it was initially when I asked, you said until 1. So I thought I won't have time after 1. I was worried about that. Okay. So
leave it to me as the chair. Leave it to me to run the meeting. Can we allow them to prepare? We're going to come back. I've been sensitized that lunch is not yet ready. But you are ready? Oh, to respond. So, okay. We should have said MEC. There's no need for us to break. Madam Chair, we are ready to respond. Okay, fine. Fire on.
Thank you, Chair, for the opportunity. As we did when we do the presentation, I'll just highlight some of them, and then the HOD will take over some of them, and then we'll be able to share among themselves. And again, because I'm as an MEC executive, I also have to respond to the issues of policies and programming, like as a general, not necessarily the specific. For example, firstly, with the issue of the Office of the Health Standards, I haven't seen the current report, but I'm aware of the other reports. And as I want to quote again Dr. Mutualedi yesterday when he was responding to such, when he indicated that as part of the Act, they are using their own yardstick and measurement. That's not necessarily a reflection of the whole system, because firstly, they have to sample in terms of where they're supposed to do their assessment. And also, again, just also to mention that it was their domains that they are focusing on. It's about around 7 domains. And when you zoom, for example, like in leadership and governance, I think there was a question about us leadership and governance, you'll find that the questions there, it's about related to the availability of the minutes of the, like, hospital boards and so forth.
So it might not necessarily be, when we say leadership and governance, it's about the whole pack of the health professionals' leadership. Also, same applies with the issue of the, for example, the patient's safety or rights. So it's also about at the time that they are going there, is there an evidence of whether it's a minute or the documentation that's related to that? So my response is not about that I am defensive of what they're saying, but I'm conquer and share what Minister Mutualedi was responding to on the issue of the health ombudsman. And then UHC, Universal Health Coverage versus NHI. Universal Coverage is an international initiative which is no one actually in his right mind could reject such. Because it covers the issue related to the equity, it covers the issue of the payment as a service, so there's no way that a person who's already ill, now there should be exchange of money at the point of service, because that time the person needs a care services. That's why it's a right thing that people need to pay and be assisted, issues of addressing equity. If they cannot pay for the so that time that now they need the services, that they don't have to be worried about such. As Honorable indicated that when the person becomes poor when the person is ill, even if the person was not poor, you end up become poor, because even with your social grant now, you have to, if you are saying eat more healthy food, you have to use the extra money to buy more of that food, the transport takes in all of those. So therefore, with the Western Cape, the issue of the universal health coverage, we support such. Now, the difference with the NHI is about the funding methodology. So the funding aspect, that's where now we find that it's a debate throughout, not only within the Western Cape, throughout about how we're going to fund it. Are you going to fund it? Are you going to take it from the Med scheme? Are they going to take whatever, all of those? But the issue of the principle of the quality of care, the equity, and also the issues of the payment, we support such in terms of the universal health cover. Also, taking further, we have the chair spoke about, was asking about, are you saying the Western Cape that you have already piloted things, or you are a trendsetter, or you have managed to fast-track things that the national, because the national process fast-track. For example, the UHSR, which is the UHC stroke NHI, we volunteered to be part, Western Cape is the only one, to be part of those streams that are the national has in terms of the implementation of the NHI. Further, we asked that actually they could pilot the aspect, because if you recall that they've got, I think, 12 or 15 districts, pilot districts where they have conducted, which is now they've reached the end stage. But we volunteered that they could make use of us, where in Saldanha, as part of the World Society approach, where we can pilot using the employers, working with the employers as well of those in those factories. And they indicated that, okay, we're not going to do it alone. Also, we must tag with another province that we can work with, which is already the documentation and the task team with the Eastern Cape. I think it's a BCM. I can't remember the other one, where already now we are piloting the NHI as according now to the act that has been going to be passed, so that we can assist for the whole of the South Africa. With the issue of the health net in terms of the pickup points, when Dr. Kluto was talking about, and Minister has been in terms of the pioneering, it has been my headache. It also responds to the old story, where you find that because of these densities in the rural areas, you go to a patient from the Beaufort West when they already have an appointment, whether going to George or going to Tygerberg or Kotzikir, because of they have to use the transport as far the distance, but they have to be here at 8 o'clock at the time of their appointment with the doctor. So the pickup points will find that the person will be picked up at midnight or even 2 a.m. or even 10 p.m. And these are people who have walked, they are farm workers mostly, quite a large distances, and then to be sitting on the tree waiting for the health net transport that is to take them. That's when I say that it cannot be. So therefore, they have to revise the pickup points and also to be safer. And of course, when I indicated that we might be responsible for health service, but health is everybody's business, hence they have to negotiate. For example, if you go to Matrix Matrix Fontaine, a Milner Hotel reception
it's a pickup point. Instead of the person waiting there under the tree, the reception says that no, we can provide such without any cost. Same as in the private hospitals, for example, in Bito, in Platt, where they can utilize it whilst they're waiting for that. So it's already been happening, but there are other areas where we have to make interim arrangements, although it might not be unofficial, where we pick the patients from their homes, because there might be four or six patients. So, and most of them are old and they are women. So why would you be still waiting for those patients instead of picking them back from home? So per each district, per each facility, you'll see in terms of that where we have strength in such a pickup point. Then the issue, social determinants, because I'm more for responding to those issues that affect the whole transversal and the whole system as a whole. With the social department, it's true, when we made an example about the poverty or wealth and health, it's true, what we see in health is mostly those things that are supposed to have been seen elsewhere, first of all, because we end up mopping the floor. That's why I joke, I normally say that I feel like I'm the MEC for the Department of Illness instead of Department of Health, because we only focus when the person is already a patient, is already inside, instead of closing the tap elsewhere. So the issue of the access to sanitation, the access to the issue related to the water, the related to all those, they impact on health. So that's why for us at the transversal level, we work other departments, because if, for example, it's a pneumonia season, and then later it's going to be DRL season. So at the end, this doesn't, our Red Cross Hospital or our pediatrics, they become full because of such. And it might not necessarily because of it has got to do that they are supposed to be ill, but because of the climate change and all of those. Therefore, we have to have such an engagement throughout. Hence, even I think last time the department was here, they presented the water health and preparedness plan about the drought. So although that probably doesn't mean the hospitals won't function, there won't be any goals, there'll still be goals and whatever, but the mere fact that there's a drought and all of those, these are all social determinants of health. It impacts on us. So we keep on having all those conversations throughout. Same applies with the nutrition and so forth. But also from our side, the preventive and promotive, because as you recall that the health in South Africa has been more of hospice-centric and curative. Hence, we find that now we have to a paradigm shift where we do the preventive and promotive. Because previously, like for example, with the diabetes, which is the major killer in our province, specifically in the metro, you do know that you can give people as much medicine as they can be, access to medicine, but it needs a whole lifestyle change. Hence now our programs on the lifestyle changes, the diet and all of those, part of the Western Cape on Wellness WOW is one of our programs where we can look at that. Same issue the ARVs, like the National Minister was indicating that we have got the biggest ARV program in the whole world. Of course, ARVs, they've made us to have a life expectancy that has increased throughout South Africa. But the issue again about the closing the tap, the new HIV infections among the young girls, which is about 2,000 people throughout South Africa. Therefore, we cannot only preach the gospel to the converted when they are already in our health facilities. Let's go outside. It now talks to the role of the community health workers. So the question, what's the difference between the community health workers, community care workers, social development, and community health workers within the health? For us, it's about they are rendering a service. What's the difference? How it used within the then for those that are working in health? One will go to the household, and then probably they find that, okay, there's a gogo who needs to be washed or something like that, maybe clip in the nails and all of those. That is a social development approach. For us, it's about extension of the primary health care. You even have what we call those on the rehabilitation care workers who have been trained further, where they will have a referral. Probably maybe it's a baby who has been discharged, a neonate who has been discharged now needs to, so that doesn't regress, needs to be also be followed at home. A patient who probably had an operation. In addition to that, now they combine with the social aspect, because when you go there to the household and then you find that, okay, there's that person probably who is very old and all of those might need some assistance. So there's a difference. And there was a question about supervision. There's a team, I'm not sure, probably they can expand on such, where you say that in that current ward, if say there are 10 community health workers and then you have a professional nurse who's attached through the NGO, and those groups, they are attached to the primary health care facility so that there is an issue in terms of a referral.
Also, we are piloting in other areas, the Kailisha, I think the Ndlovini side, and the town too, where they are using their mobiles. They've been trained to use the mobile phones, so when they go there, they can capture. If probably they want more information about the patient, it might be that's when they can pick up, especially for the children. Patients who have probably who have been defaulting. So that's where now the system can pick up them and then they send information immediately as part of catch and match. So they can be catch and match. And then I'm skipping. I'm going to the other issue that was clinical committees. I think there was a question about the clinical committees, whether it's legislated or not. To 2011, Western Cape has got an act in terms of the hospital board, appointment and nomination of the hospital boards, which we have been using that throughout. 2015, which was passed in 2016, health committees, clinic committees, they've been part of, actually they've been before the hospital board, but they've never been recognized in terms of the legislation. And it was really unfair because some of them, it would be the really people who go out of their way volunteering to assist. So that's when now I revised the hospital board to include the health committees, which was passed. So now we've got one legislation for both of those. And what we have, and also we've got also the directives in terms of how to the nomination and also how to cluster because we've got the rural. In some of the clinics for the PHC, it might be one main clinic with four satellites. Each satellite we have three mobile. So I'm going to say now you must have it was a minimum. I think it's eight. I'm going to have now eight. Instead of probably you may say that you might have one or two, and then we have got the mobiles plus the satellites plus this plus something like that. So that's why now it took it longer in terms of clustering them and also what incentives that we need to provide for them. I think let me stop there.
Thank you very much, Minister. Honourable members and chairperson, so I've kind of will respond and cover as most as possible. There were a few questions about governance and finance and supply chain, so I'll just cover them as a collective. There was a question about the audit outcomes and irregular and fruitless, etc., as part of the first aspect related to governance. In 2016-17, our fruitless and wasteful of the 21.5 billion was 7,000 rand, and in the past year they couldn't find anything. As far as irregular expenditure is concerned, we've over the years, Madam Chair, with a lot of very, very hard work, we've reduced the amount of irregular expenditure. It is now below the level of materiality. So we are waiting the final outcome for this audit that has just been concluded or still in process. But we are engaging with the Auditor General on a regular basis to understand and respond to queries from their side. So we are very much in tight relationship with the Auditor General to be able to be more responsive, and if there are questions that we can respond immediately. The issue of supply chain, we've got a very tight monitoring system to check whether we pay payments within 30 days. I personally sign that off every month, and if there's any payment beyond 30 days, we investigate and understand what has happened here. And there are some logistics, for example, in your big hospitals, where the delivery happens in one place, and then the invoice has to find its place to the payment office, and very often, so we're working very tight on that, and very often the suppliers don't stamp the invoices. So there's a lot of stuff in detail that we're looking, but the payment within 30 days, to us, that is one of the sacrosanct issues, because we know we have to support suppliers and very often small businesses to be able to continue. So that is something that we work on very hard. Then, Madam Chair,
from part, as part of governance, the honourable member mentioned that there are issues in the Office of Health Standards Compliance. I'll come back later also to the Office of Health Standards Compliance issues. Do we have accountability? Do we have governance systems? Do we have oversight? Do we have strategic planning? And what is our strategic approach in the department? As part of our governance presentation, Madam Chair, I have indicated that we've got structures in place for accountability, both for finances as well as for patient outcomes, quality services, and also whether we are achieving our goals and our targets as in the APP. There's also oversight visits that are happening both from the minister's side, but also from myself and senior management, but it's not oversight to find what's going wrong. It is oversight to find what's going right, and if there are areas that one is to that one has to improve, one go with an enabling approach. So we will get the full report of the Office of Health Standards Compliance. There is a date in June that we will get the full report, the recent report. But I have to really indicate that every hospital and every clinic take the report of the Office of Health Standards Compliance very seriously. They are obliged to develop an improvement plan, and they are held accountable for the improvement processes that they do put in place. And the Office of Health Standards Compliance also then come and visit and have follow-up visits to see whether those things have happened. We are the first to recognize there's still a lot to be done. I take the point of one of the honourable members in terms of whether our internal assessments, how do they correlate to the office, and we will see when the full report comes to what extent there are differences and what makes those differences. Is it the interpretation issue, etc. We have found, Madam Chair, something that we're working with the office is that, for example, if you must have a tablet in your pharmacy that is a 20 milligram tablet, but you only have a 10 milligram tablet, and you're dishing out two of those to the patients because the 20 milligram is out of stock, the office marks that as wrong, non-compliant, although you still give two tablets for make up 20 milligram. So there are issues that we're dealing with the office to be able to say what is meaningful in terms of that aspect. As far as the ideal clinic is concerned, satellite clinics very often have one or two nurses, and then the full 189 indicators are then applied to that satellite clinic. And we do try to work with our national colleagues so that is there perhaps a more meaningful way? Can we connect and make sure that we improve? Because both the national core standards and the ideal clinic are input factors. It is not output and outcome factors. And so we work very hard on the output and the outcome, but we also recognize that input and process are critical stuff for us to improve. So we've got a lot of processes to really make sure that those things do happen, and we recognize that we've got some work to do. As far as infrastructure is concerned, there was a question whether we are planning, because there is a national concern about planning for infrastructure, and also when you commission, you've got the money to commission. I have reflected in one of the slides that as part of our Healthcare 2030 plan, we've got a hospital plan up till 2030, and we are concluding also a primary healthcare plan up till 2030, so that we know which hospitals will be built, how many beds should they have, where will they be built, etc. So that plan is in place, and we systematically take that, we revise that from time to time, but we also take it forward. So we do believe that we've got the plan in place, and it does speak to our long-term vision that we have promised the community of the Western Cape as part of 2030. Madam Chair, then there were questions about the IT, the information technology systems, etc., and one of the questions that you specifically asked, Madam Chair, was the unique patient identifier, is that the national system that we are implementing, or what is it? So we are fortunate to have 14 years of experience of having the unique patient identifier in our province. And we worked very closely with the national department in developing the national system. But there's a lot of stuff that they are doing beyond that, and we actually had a meeting last week on how do we work collaboratively more, that we learn, that we benefit from both learning. So we are grateful that we can contribute, but also grateful for the experiences that we have had over time. Then, Madam Chair, would like to go to the Office of Health Standards Complaint. The Minister answered but most of the questions, but there was one particular question that was asked about, in the same line, if you look at our complaints and compliments, I'm talking about quality in general now, in the same slide, we've got complaints and complaints on, compliments on the same issue, and that is the reality. We get people who complain on the care that they receive, but we also get patients who give us compliments on the care that they receive. So on the same category, we get both complaints and compliments. And in the slide, I've shown that for every complaint in that space, we have about 8 compliments. So we feel proud of that, but we know that there's still a lot to be done to improve all of the others. But that just explained, I think the colleague said there's conflicting matters. And then, Madam Chair, you asked about others. To fit everything on one slide, we had to indicate what are the big aspects. So the others are really small components, but we can get you that detail if you so wish. Then, Madam Chair, there were several questions on human resources or people management matters, the staffing profile, etc. I would like to, at the outset, apologize to the committee that we have not been consistent in our terminology of African black and black, and that was, unfortunately, we didn't pick it up. It's something that we should have picked up. There's also abbreviations used, and I apologize for that. The honorable member asked that these more interesting program, primary health care. So primary health care is program 2. So program 2 received 40% of the budget, and they've got the total staff is 12,000. So that's by far the largest investment that we make in health care in this province, in primary health care. So that was a question, and we should have been out writing it out. But it's the same program structure that across all provinces has exactly the same program structure. So program 2 is always primary health care. So we should have picked that up. But coming back to people management issues, Madam Chair, there was a question about the vacancy rates. So for program 2, the vacancy rate is 4.3%. So we define a vacancy rate for posts that you've got money for. It doesn't help to measure posts that you don't have money for, because that doesn't give a true reflection of your reality. So we believe 4% is kind of largely reflecting the turnover. And your question, Madam Chair, does it include your interns and your contract workers? It does include that. So we work, we recognize that our contract staff, your intern is appointed on contract, your community service people are appointed on contract, your registrars are appointed on contract. All of them are in that part of the turnover, but then in terms of the vacancy rate, that also reflects there. Then there was a particular question about the staffing profile. So on the one slide, we reflect the staffing profile of the whole of the department. So, for example, in the whole of the department, African blacks make up 30%. Yet, and that is where our challenge lies, Madam Chair. We recognize that upfront, and we discuss that very frequently. What are the strategies and the mechanisms to make sure that we allow people to progress up to the SMS level? At the SMS level, it is small. It is a small percentage. I don't have it with me now. Perhaps my colleagues can just quickly help to find it. It is not that large percentage that we should work with. But interestingly, we are currently in the process of shortlisting for director level posts. Now, one of the DPSA requirements is for you to be shortlisted for a director post, you must have 5 years in a deputy director post. So now we've got this one amazing woman who has been acting in a director post for 2.5 years. African black woman. Amazing. I can't shortlist her, because the rules are saying that's it. So it's important that the whole of government must help us to improve our reality. And that woman is so good, we're going to lose her. She's going to move elsewhere. So we are working from our department side to see what we can do to create an environment, identify people with potential, take it forward, and really make sure that we can change the profile. But we are the first to recognize that is one of the challenges that we sit with in the province. There was a point that we also need to put disabled as Madam Fiebel. We could put that into a small number of people.
but we couldn't put that. But the biggest challenge, Madam Chair, that was posed to us is on slide 67, which talks about, slide 68, on the challenges of staffing. The one is the impact of the increase in the public sector wage bill. So when negotiations happen at the national level for salary increases, there's no link to the budget that provinces receive. So if the salary increases goes up more than what national treasury is providing to the provinces, we just don't have the money, but we are compelled to pay the increases. So that means that you are forced to appoint less and less and less people because they earn more money, but we don't have the same more money. So that is the catch-22 that we sit in. But the question was, how do we deal with that? Unfortunately, we can't. That's national processes, national decisions. The only thing that we can do is that how do we respond as best as possible? We have to pay people the increased salaries, but then we know that we can appoint less people, so where do we take those decisions? One of the questions were, is there a moratorium on the filling of posts? No, there's no moratorium on the filling of posts. But you have to be very careful when you decide every post that you do for. The second point there was the budget pressures, limits, filling of posts. I've just explained that. Staff safety is one of our major concerns, and I'm glad that the committee also picked up the issue of EMS. We fail to understand how the same community who are actually most in need of the service, there are elements in that community that attack ambulances, that prevents ambulances. And in the presentation that was made on EMS response times, we indicated the number of days that staff are now sitting at home due to post-traumatic stress, that they can't come to work because of what has happened. They tell me that if they ride in that same street where the attack happened, they get that sense of anxiety. When any ambulance is attacked, the whole radio system knows, and all the staff gets that sense of anxiety. And that is the same story we took to the courts to say that if you give a judgment on a person who just took a cell phone, you regard that as petty crime. But the impact on the whole of the population of the Western Cape is not petty crime. It is a whole system that is negatively affected. So on that basis, we have three people who have now been convicted to 12 years in prison just for stealing a cell phone. Because we've made the case to the courts to say that this can't be, you can't regard that as petty cash. Whether that will have an impact on theft, on attacks on ambulances, we will have to see. But it's a community. We do believe that the community have to respond. One of the strategies we're looking at, for example, is that as soon as a patient phones the ambulances, get all your neighbors to wait with you outside. So when the ambulance comes, they can help us to protect the ambulance because they are at their highest risk at the time that they reach the patient. But I am very passionate about this, and I don't want to go further. But this is a big, big issue for us in the department. Madam Chair, then there were questions about waste management, and you also had questions. Some of those are the high profile. I would like to come to those as well. Waste management, on the slide, we have indicated that we are monitoring even the places where the waste is being handled, because we believe we are accountable for how that company that we've contracted is handling the waste, if there are doing that responsibly, and the Department of Environmental Affairs is working with us in that regard. Very often we ask them to go and do the inspection and give us a report because we are concerned. So we do that. The way that waste is being transported, exactly the same. We check the transport from time to time. We've got people who check. So these contracts are done at the center, but the checking happens both at the facility level, but then also at the provincial level. Madam Chair, then there were questions about insourcing versus outsourcing. As a department, we look carefully
at how to best render the services with the available resources that we do have. So some of the services we've got mixed, for example, in security. If you go to Khayelitsha Hospital, there are a few people inside the facility, it's our staff. They monitor the contract because they know the standards and they know what to look for all those services that, that have been contracted out. So we do have all of those. Madam Chair, then there was a few specific questions. For example, donations of medicine. So the national department, because of the shortfall in the HIV grant, they're giving us donations of stock that they source, and we regard that as donations, but they then go to the patient. So they are then handled in that regard. Madam Chair, then you had a few very particular questions. One of them is that the very unfortunate incident where a patient was very advanced and actually incurable cancer that went missing in Stellenbosch Hospital. I recently visited Stellenbosch to understand what has happened. If one goes there and you put yourself in the position of this patient, the only way that that patient could get into the ceiling was a steep ladder incline like this. Now the patient in that condition, pulling himself up in that way in the ceiling, must have been extremely desperate about his situation. The nurse went out, it was 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. She went out for 15 minutes because the patient soiled the linen, to quickly go and fetch linen. When she came back, the patient was gone. Got sepsis to the hospital. Nobody thought of looking in the ceiling because they were contractors. But that's what happened. And we are, it's really one of those things. But it is unfortunate. We have asked for a police investigation, and they are supporting us in that regard. Then there was a question about the replacement of Geef Joost Hospital. So it will be, Geef Joost Hospital was a district hospital. We are replacing it with a regional hospital because of the load of cases in that community. So it will be Klipfontein Regional Hospital. We've already considered that. And the site has been identified. The business case has been submitted to National Department of Health. We are awaiting the final outcome from the National Department of Health. We are engaging with the site where the hospital will be built, and there are interactions with the communities, with the VPU NGO, who together with the City of Cape Town is working with us on that. So there's in-depth conversation. Now, clearly, can you consult the whole community? No. We're looking at those people that the community has nominated to work with us in that regard. Sorry.
If you say the site, because make us to understand, if you say a site has been identified, is it a site that is outside the normal jurisdiction, or is it a site within where, so that we, yeah.
Thank you for that question, Madam Chair. It's a site within, but you can just imagine that there are not many sites available. So there are negotiations on for that site, but we've got the feedback that the negotiations are there and that we will be able to continue to start with fencing off the space. So it's very close from that facility. So we are very, very happy that we'll be able to finalise that. Then, Madam Chair, you had questions about stop training nurses. That I would love to hear what happened there, because that is absolutely not the case. And then, Madam Chair, there was a particular questions, firstly about interns, but then particularly about oncology services. I would like to go to oncology services. And so we've got 17 oncologists in our province, and we've got 17 registrars that are oncologists in training, and we've got oncologists that we are training for the rest of Africa that are here on training, and we support their development. I don't have to go into the detail of the equipment, Madam Chair, but equipment we systematically over years, we've prioritized oncology, radiation oncology equipment over the years. But as I said, one piece of equipment is 20, 30 million rand of big ticket stuff. So all of them are functional. So we are, but oncology is not only high level equipment. Oncology starts at the primary care level, to identify when a woman's got a lump in a breast, to start tracking cancer services from that point. So we are looking at the whole system of cancer care and not only at the high end. But I know that in the public domain, the whole issue of oncologists were there. Madam Chair,
I think I've covered most of the issues, so thank you for that opportunity.
No, thank you very much. I think my salary, is there something that has not been? Use your mic. Honorable myself.
I'm not clear about this transformation thing. And you didn't explain it very clearly, so I get the sense of what it is all about. And we can use what we call job reservation type of legislation to keep people out of jobs because they haven't got 5 years experience. By the time she's got 5 years waiting, she's no more interested in that job. She's doing something else. So just tell us, are you transformed or you're still waiting for this woman to spend 5 years somewhere before she can be elevated and we talk about transformation? We just want to know whether you are transformed, and if not, what are you doing about it and how you are going about doing it. Thanks.
Thank you. That's a very valid question. My apology if I didn't explain that properly. So although the whole of our staff profile, 30% are African black, at the SMS level, not even 10, but just below 10% are African black. 8%. So that is our challenge. And what we try to say that how can we identify and have a mechanism to pull people. Every post that goes vacant, we see it as opportunity, but also if we've got deputy directors in our system, how can we get those people to be able to have the best exposure and the developmental opportunities and mentorship to be able to get into the system? The example I used was that how national policies are in this particular case preventing us. Because the National Department of Public Service and Administration policy says that you cannot become an SMS member. You cannot be shortlisted or interviewed unless you have 5 years of experience in a deputy director post. Now this woman's got 2.5 years. So do I wait a further 2.5 years and not fill the post? And these are the difficult issues, but Madam Chair, I think What I would like the honourable members to recognise is that we recognise we've got a challenge, and we are putting a lot of processes in place, both for professionals, but also non-professionals, to get them through the system and give them opportunities. There was a question about stability in the top management, that's part of our reality, that we've got. In our top management, we've got a person that recently got his 40 years certificate. Some of them have got 20 or 30 years service certificate. So people have been committed to the public sector for years. That influences the profile of the service. And it takes time for us to make the transformation. But we've got stability. And there are people with a lot of corporate memory in our system that helps us to sustain this department to go forward.
In short, you are not transforming and you are not transformed. That's the bottom line.
Can we then say within that was a very important question. And I don't think today we'll then be able to address that because as we respond, there are a number of issues that are then coming to the floor. Can we then say we will maybe we'll look into this, maybe as a committee within the context of transformation, and also checking, communicating with the Public Service Administration in terms of looking into this. And I think as we are moving forward, we will then have to look into that because when you respond, you talk about institutional memory, then people with 20 to 40 years, when with 20, 30 years in the service, and how then do you keep that memory, which is very important. But there is this question, which is fundamental, that how then do we ensure that we transform the system? And we'll have to look into that, but we're not going to be able to do that today. In closing, I want there are just a couple of issues that I would like you to which are very important. We will request that from you. Governance within the context of hospital boards. How many of those are functional within the... I'm raising that because we are to assist if there is a need for empowerment, because I'm of the view, and I must be told, let me see if I'm wrong, a hospital board of Tiger Beg, Red Cross, Groteskem will not be in the same, in terms of empowerment, with that of Khayelitsha and whatever. So we'd like to get that so that we're then able to have a follow-up question on that. Yes, when we call the East, the Western Cape in terms of, what is, zero whatever on drought, we were well aware that hospitals are to function. They are going to function even if they, but we have got that responsibility, not when things fall apart, it's at that time that we wake up. But we wanted to have an understanding of the state of readiness of the health sector in the province. So we think that that was it within that context. I am a bit uncomfortable with how fine I understand. Let me not start about the uncomfortableness. I understand the challenge of EMSs, the frustrations that are there in the department. But it can't be. A challenge of EMS is not a Cape Town issue. It's a country. I would have thought that as the Western Cape, you will then say, with what as the Western Cape we have done, we have motivated, we have ensured that people that are doing this crime bear the price. It's, we would appreciate and we lobby, I'm making an example, let me say that, we lobby other provinces that they are to ensure that people, this is a petty crime, yes, but what is the impact of it right across in the country? Because Eastern Cape has got the same problem. Gauteng, in fact, three. It's Gauteng, it's Western Cape, it's Eastern Cape. I'm not quite sure with the others. Northwest. As the country, this is what... So the uncomfortableness, in my view, is reducing this to the Western Cape as if it's only a Western Cape matter, but it is a country matter. And EMS is really, they are frustrated. But will it not be important that, because in the thing of the Office of Health Standard Compliance, safety of patients, that it's not only in the EMS, it's right across the staff. We're not quite sure in terms of the Western Cape, how staff are being, the violence in our institution in relation to health workers, how is that affecting them? So I do think that as one was listening to your presentation, maybe there are areas that, lessons that we are to draw, but there are lessons that we are to engage further. And the Office of the Health Standard Compliance, in terms of their 2016, they do reflect on some of some of the clinics that have gone down. We are hampering on clinics among others because MC clinics are a feeder to hospitals. So you can't talk about hospitals outside of at one point or another looking into the state of clinics. But when we see a need of calling you back or writing a memo for you to reflect on some of the issues that we may have thought that we need more clarity, it is fine. But thank you very much, and until we again, but let me, I think it's important to really reflect that, like all other provinces, at least Western Cape, when called, because I do call MECs and HODs when I am called by a member of community, which I can't ask, where did you get my number from? So immediately when I get that, I And relative, you have responded on some of the issues. The only area where you are weak a bit is the feedback. So just based on the chair, this is what we have done. The patient is this is what, but in it, relatively, the department through the MEC and the HOD do come back when there is an issue that is being raised by community. We will then, after when we have our lunch, members, we will then.
Because you were the first, and then we're meeting other provinces. Probably, I thought could suggest, because you have made a suggestion about how do we do things across provinces, especially when it affects all of us. So probably maybe to ask, if possible, members, other provinces also probably to share how we have worked in some other aspects. Because actually the safety, the Eastern Cape, we are working closely with them, and they've been here with us. Same applies with the issue of the oncology KZN in Free State. So probably if they could themselves to indicate that how do they work and what kind of some of the assistance we do with them. Because we don't want to make things that this is political and then we brag. We are bragging about ourselves. We don't want to brag about how we assist others. Because at the end, it's all about the patient.
Thank you very much. We will be in M314 after lunch, because that's where we will meet Gauteng. Thank you very much.